Hello, everybody. I'm Chris.
I'm Craig.
I'm known as Jack.
Oh, you dick.
Just ignore it. It's good. It's all fine. It's the new year.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Happy New Year.
Should we talk about, sorry about lack of a Christmas special? John Cleese is the first person named in this.
Wow.
Yeah, sorry we didn't make any Christmas specials. We were just basically a bit busy.
Yeah.
Yes, yes, the schedules collided.
I've got something Christmassy.
Alphabetical.
We've
got Ferrero Rochers. They're pretty Christmassy, aren't they?
Yeah. And little Christmas tree shortbreads,
which are nice.
Yeah, because it's like when you get they came out of those sort of swanky musical box tin things that you get now, which are clearly the point of is just to have the tin
because
they're pretty generic.
They're nice though.
We'll be glad to hear we've had our tea as well.
Yes, we've had
so we won't be eating sausage rolls and things.
No, I think
we need to knock that out.
Yeah, those days are in the past, kiddos. We're getting older now, it's not good for our indigestion.
Yeah, can't do that.
What are we watching?
Who are you asking?
We're
watching Time Bandits.
Yay!
Because I think I might have requested this.
You have.
Because I love this film.
It's a great film.
And I think there's lots to talk about.
Well, have we watched any other handmade films?
I don't think we have.
I don't think we've done any other handmade.
And they really ought to be key texts.
Yeah, they're required reading, really. But, I mean, in fact, in the Anatomy of Cinema, which is our sort of...
our Bible.
Our Bible. I wrote a chapter
on handmade
films.
Does that make you God?
No. No. It doesn't even make me Rich Ralfordson.
Doesn't make you bored.
Might make me Gabriel the Toad.
Yay!
Yay!
Stalwarts of 70s and 80s television here. Yeah. Do we know their names?
So is he?
Well, that's Derek Draper.
Is he Derek Draper? Isn't he David Dacre?
Derek Draper's
the Labour
Oh, yeah, Derek Draper was the
Labour guy. Oh, yes, that's right. Sorry, I beg your pardon. I've just double D.
And he turned into like a psychologist or something, didn't he?
Yeah,
Dolly
the other.
Draper he was known as.
The other double D of. Of 70s and 80s sitcom is Derek Deadman.
Deadman, yeah.
All right.
Who is a dead man.
Yes,
I was going to say, surely it's Barbara Windsor.
And who's the lady?
Who is the lady?
I don't know,
but she's great. She's in loads of things. She wasn't in George and Mildred, was she?
Oh, is she the neighbour?
Is she the neighbour's mum? And there's Jim Broadbent?
Yes.
No, I was reading something about this morning, and it claims that...
Which is Wikipedia.
No, it wasn't Wikipedia. Right, okay. It claims that it's set slightly in the future. I don't think that's the case.
No, I always presumed it was just set...
Yeah, it's present day.
...contemporaneously, as people say.
What's the basis for thinking this?
I don't know. They didn't substantiate
it. Is it because of all of the...
It's like a plot synopsis.
I mean, actually, I can kind of see that. I mean, I don't agree with it, but I can kind of see why people would think that, because of all of the gadgets that they have.
Right.
Yeah.
You might think is at the when this came out, which I think was 1984?
No, 81.
81?
Yeah.
Wow.
Not a film I saw at the cinema. I wanted to, but never did.
Came and went quite
possibly because of my parents' antipathy towards Monty Python.
Okay.
It was a big hit. Made lots of money.
Yeah, it did. And in fact, I think I'm right in saying that for a very short period...
look at that. That's an extraordinary cut, isn't it?
Michael Palin, during his very short period as one of the world's most successful leading men, was in like at a few of the top spots in the American top 10 chart.
Did he?
Yeah.
What else was he in at the time then?
Well, just after this, he was in The Missionary.
Well, when he came out,
was a big hit,
The Missionary was a big hit in America. Yeah. In fact, The Missionary at one point, I think, because it was the year after this, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Overtook E.T.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Just on a week by week.
A week on week basis.
Like he's got a little
legs. Yeah.
And he's a very good runner, Michael Palin, as we know. He did a lot of money. He's great. Look at him.
Yeah, he's a fantastic actor.
So, did you see it in the cinema?
No, Jackson. I think the first time. My first awareness of it was via Tiswas.
Right.
I think it was one of those.
Oh, and
they're not in Tiswas.
What was the name of that section in Tiswas? Where they used to show Gobbo's Corner. No, where they used to show bits of a film.
I remember,
During the and they were basically it was almost like before they would show instead of showing a trailer they were allowed to show bits of a film over the course of the morning.
And I think
what was it called? It was called like Cinema Cine Celly or something daft.
But was it like movie? Movie
Magic or Movie Madness? Yeah. She is actually very Euphra Joyce there.
She is a bit, yeah.
Didn't she?
But yeah. I seem to also think that David Rappaport was on Tissot's Quantum.
It was, yeah.
Yeah, he was. But so, he was also on.
He played a character in
Saturday Starship and yeah, and, right. and things like that as well.
So that was my first exposure.
Made America and then
Time Bandits, and then I think it was then when it was on Channel 4, and it was one of the. One of the suite of films that our family recorded and my dad used to like watching a lot.
Nice. I find Your Money or Your Life really quite disturbing.
It is very disturbing. It's very, yeah. There's a lot, this is where it's most Gilliam, this film, stuff yeah. like that, isn't it? And also the kitchen's very like the kitchen in Brazil yes, with all the strange is, yeah. gadgets and things.
But there's
I've written some notes down here.
But there's a lot of stuff that is very contemporary though, like the sort of optic light on top of the telly and mm-hmm. the pictures. On the wall with children with big eyes and all that. All that's very of its time. Mm-hmm.
That's that fucking staircase from Tales from the Crypt.
What do we think of this little lad?
He's very good.
He's good, isn't he? He never did anything else, did he?
No, apparently it was actually his brother who auditioned and he came along with him. And they decided that they got him to come up.
Is that what happened with you and your brother's careers?
The old woman in Your Money or Your Life was for a long time the generic old woman.
Yeah.
In adverts and telly and things. Mm-hmm.
The other thing I wanted to say about Your Money or Your Life is that was the golden age of quiz show pastiche, which I think kind of ends with Filthy Rich and Cat Flap, of the quiz show hosts with the
Spangler jacket and all that sort of thing.
Yeah,
I think probably because the nature of game shows changed and people became a bit more Monkhouse, a bit more sleek and well-dressed. Yeah. It also because I think for a long time game shows were associated more with American television.
That's fucking state that wee bastard's room.
I know. I'd get clattered if my room was like
But there's also references.
Of course, the best one is You Should Be So.
You Should Be So Lucky.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, that's
the
title with Mr. Bennett.
In between cleaning up the dungeons in Indiana Jones.
There's lots of references in his room, aren't there, to the adventures he's going to
yeah,
have.
In fact, you'll see right at the very end that the actual set with the confrontation is laid out on the floor.
Oh. Now, Chris, when did you first experience
I think Bandits? I think I've made reference in a previous commentary to our former friend, Tammy Hinehall, who lived not far from here in the early 80s in a big house in the east end of Glasgow. And who had a sister, I think, who had a video shop, and therefore used to
when
come round
a
people's...
sister, I think.
I'm not sure if it was a sister or sister-in-law or cousin
me.
Or something.
Excuse me. Or were you not sure if it was a woman or a man?
Oh, sorry. No, I'm sure it was a woman. I like the way you insist on talking over me while you talk over me.
Yeah, but I did it quite cleverly. Excuse me.
I'm pretty sure it was a sister. Anyway, all this Jack Purvis. Yeah. Anyway, the point is, he used to come round with boxes of, like, videos from the shop.
Jack Purvis?
You had to reach down to get them.
Not in later life.
But they had things, you know, I think that's how we saw War Purvis. Games. He brought that down. But it was also, he brought Time Bandits at request, at my dad's request. Because he really wanted to see it.
And did your dad like it?
Why didn't he like it?
There you go, things. That's fucking lovely, that. Windows will never cease.
Yeah. My problem with War Games is I didn't know what Tic Tac Toe was.
I like War Games.
I didn't know what Tic Tac Toe was, but to be fair, Jack, I worked it out quite quickly.
Yeah.
When they started playing Noughts and Crosses.
No, I was thinking it's clearly has a similar genus to Noughts and Crosses.
Is that what you thought? Similar genus. Oh, there's Big Boy the Good.
Remember when she puts her legs either side of him to not let him pass, and she's been kind of teenage flirty with him?
No.
That gave me such a horn when I was about 12.
That's good.
It's also my first exposure to Sir Dabney Coleman.
Yeah, it's great.
So
what's his name's in it as well? John Wood.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Right, I think you'll find.
That's great. I like how they've got all this stick all sorted out.
Yeah, like they're they actually are a proper little team.
Apparently, they all hated David Rappaport.
Because he was the star.
Yeah, and he wouldn't fraternise with them.
Oh,
so
really?
You know the scene where they all fall out.
Mm-hmm.
They actually wrote that on set as a response to the fact that they all fell out.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, funny you should say that, because
mm-hmm.
that leads us into a bit of a discussion. About handmade films. The production of Time Bandits was pretty fraught. I love this.
If you look behind him there, you've got the Napoleon you had and his soldiers
had. Robin Hood.
You know, can I tell you something right now?
Go on.
Uh-huh. I hadn't noticed that before.
Hi.
Yeah, there we go. So the production, Chris.
The production was pretty fraught.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of people fell out. It wasn't a happy experience for most people involved on it.
Were the difficulties on a Terry Gilliam set?
It's hard to believe. There were problems to do with Dennis O'Brien, who was George Harrison's partner in Handmade Films.
Yeah.
Who was everybody famous and Rich's tax accountant. Because by the time he was finished, they were just famous. And, oh, this totally wiped me out when I first saw it. It was so thrilling. Anyway, it does mean that the epic song at the end, which we'll get to at the end, was actually written by George Harrison and Ray Cooper as a sort of a, well, why don't we just all get on together, look what we've created, everybody just get along and have fun.
We were talking about this today, and I said that I'd heard that Harrison had written it as a riposte to Gilliam or something.
Yeah, well, it, like I say, it was sort of him and Ray Cooper, and Ray Cooper also did the music on it.
Is this a good point to ask the people who listen to this whether or not they think this is a good impression of Terry Gilliam?
Go on.
Because Jack says no, Chris likes it.
It's big boy.
The people decide it's big boy. There you go.
Yeah, see, that's like that. Quite a good
that's
impression.
A perfectly good impression of Terry Gilliam.
Can you give me some more context? Can you do something else?
He does it all the time. He goes, oh, right, oh, and then I made a film.
I suppose, you're right.
Yeah, he does, yeah.
I suppose the ironic thing is he'd laugh like that and then make Eric the Viking and nobody else laughed.
Yeah, Eric the Viking I saw the day before I went to university.
Really?
Yeah.
I saw that in the pictures.
Is that what made you go to university?
Pretty much I thought
you
I can't.
Were going to
I
Viking.
Did that. I said, Dad, I'm abandoning that idea of just sitting about watching films because all the time. I'm going to study English at university.
I did that terrible thing where I convinced lots of pals from school to go and see it and then was like, you know, victimised for a long time for exposing them to it. You know the thing
what
about
film?
the little window opening with them all falling out. I was completely obsessed with
it's
for
good,
a long
it? Yeah.
time. Yeah.
No,
I'm not sure it appeared. I'm not sure it had appeared in very many things before this. That sort, which is a standard concept now.
Yeah,
I've written something down here, which is I found from Wikipedia.
Have you written Father Lionel Fun?
No. I might.
Are you sure?
There is a theory that the six.
Oh yes,
dwarfs.
Yeah,
Are analogous to the six members of Monty
Python. Oh yes, I've heard that.
And they are supposed to be Fidget, who's the nice one, is Michael Palin.
Michael Palin, yes.
Yep. Randall, the horrible, bossy, grasping one.
Can we guess who they all are?
Yes.
Yeah, let's
John
do that.
Cleese.
Yeah.
Correct.
Hard to believe.
Yeah. Strutter, the rather sort of annoying, aggressive one.
Eric Idle. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. Doing well.
OG, the nice, quiet one.
Terry Jones.
No.
Chapman.
Chapman.
Oh yes, of course, Chapman.
Wally,
a bit fruity?
Who's just kind of a bit daft,
the Terry Jones.
Is Terry Jones, and Vermin, the smelly one, is Terry Gilliam. So there you go.
That sounds about right to me.
So what was the budget for this film?
$5 million, which is quite a decent.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's no doubt he is a terrific visual filmmaker.
Oh yeah,
he's not great at storytelling.
No, he's not terribly good at structure.
No. But the stuff looks
beautiful. You know what he's really, really good at? Getting people to pay for his films.
Aye, yeah, he is.
For no reason that I can understand.
It's kind of weird, isn't it?
Because they don't make anything like the money that they cost. I mean, sometimes they do. But, you know,
I think
not
only about
very
price.
Fucking often.
So this is one of his...
And this 12 one Monkeys made a shitload of money.
12 Monkeys made a lot of money. Right. But, I mean, The Adventures of Baron Munchausen actually must almost bankrupted the entire European film industry. And closed at least one studio.
It lost about 38 million, which is fuck all now.
Yeah, there's nothing now, but I mean, at the time, it had the biggest budget of any film made in Europe at the time.
Wow.
I love Barnum
and somehow they managed. Yeah, it's an epic film. But somehow they managed. How he managed to convince them to pay it, keep it going, and to star John Neville.
Yeah, I know, who hadn't made a film in about 25 years
and
or something.
And who nobody had a fucking clue who he was. Yeah. And that clearly now would have to be a major star to pin that something.
I thought it was Bergerac.
I thought it was Neville Coggle, the former professor of English at Oxford.
It's on Nettles.
Yeah.
Oh, I see, right, okay. Oh, Jesus Christ. But of course, a lot of the problems, were to do with the budget. And Dennis O'Brien trying to constantly keep the costs down.
And did you know that Gilliam wanted to make Brazil rather than this?
He did make it.
He wanted to do that. But what's his face?
Dennis O'Brien.
Yeah, didn't like Brazil at all, so they ended up doing this instead.
Yeah. Oh, sure, okay.
This is a great film. You're also a great fan of Jabberwocky.
Oh, I love Jabberwocky. It's an extraordinary film.
Can I bring up something that I think is a strength of Terry Gilliam's? In fact, Craig, you identified this one then.
Did I? There you go. Yeah.
World building.
Ah.
And I think it's particularly a particular strength in 12 Monkeys.
Yeah.
And I think it does.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, it does. I go for that, yeah.
So there's all sorts of little bits of minutiae in all of his films that is coherent with the world.
Mm-hmm. But you get the impression that's the thing that he's interested in.
I think, yeah.
More than anything else, you know what I mean? He's an artist, isn't he? He's a designer, you know.
Because 12 Monkeys...
And look at that. This looks fantastic.
Yeah.
That whole culture of the 12 Monkeys feels to me massively authentic. Like, if that was going to exist, that's how it would look.
Yeah. It's also a rare film that gets great performances from Brad Pitt and Bruce Willis.
That's true.
Because Bruce Willis doesn't do that kind of what I'd always refer to as his sort of white guy, black guy thing. Yeah. Sort of go, you know, this music. There's even a scene when he's listening to old music and he reacts to it like a child. He doesn't do that kind of knowing street arsehole sort of thing that he does in almost every other film. He's a dreadful person, isn't he?
He is a dreadful person, in my view.
Yeah.
But you know, another film that he actually doesn't do the bad bit but is good is The Fifth Element.
He actually acts in the fifth element. Both from the same period.
Yeah,
pretty much the same year.
But I wonder if that's just because they're working with directors that he's sort of not in a position to argue with.
Yeah, because he's apparently a terrible director. Ian Holm is Napoleon.
Yeah. He's great in this, isn't he?
He is. Again, Napoleon, that was a good period for him, because he was an alien just before this.
A smallish, very angry, obstropolous character.
I get the joke, but what I'm saying is he is apparently quite a difficult wee fellow.
He is apparently quite a small person.
He's very old. Yeah, he's very old now. Yeah. He's mid to late 80s, I think, now.
Yeah, well, since he lost the ring, he's aged quite rapidly.
I think if you lost your ring,
time would go slowly for you.
Is this going to be the Curse of Creambag Films?
Oh, there was another one. It's true.
I think this is Charles. Oh, no, she's not. People like Charles McKeown always crop up in these films.
I thought
films.
That looked like Chris Lang on there. Oh, no.
It did look a bit like
I think it's David Leland.
Ah.
He went on to be a writer and director.
I mentioned...
And also has the great bit in River.
That's Charles McKeown. Yeah. Oh, and Ray Cooper. I think we were talking about this earlier and you asked who Ray Cooper was. He's a musician, percussionist, very accomplished.
And he did the music for this?
He did the... He certainly collaborated the music on it. He appears very prominently in The Adventures of Baron Munchausen.
Oh, right.
He is Jonathan Pryce's silent sidekick.
Ah, right, okay. I mean, this is very Munchausen, this one, isn't it? The orchestra pit in the theatre.
Yeah. Well, you can see how that influenced, you know, the trying to stage something in a disaster.
Yes. And what's the story around...
His face.
And actually, when you're a kid, certainly when I was a kid, one of the sequences in this that stuck with me was them singing as they do Me and My Shadow.
Yeah, it's nice, isn't it?
Yes, it is great. Yeah. So what had Gideon made before this then? So Jabberwocky, was that before this? Or
Jabberwocky was the first, was Terry Gilliam's pretty much first.
Because he co-directed The Holy Grail, didn't he?
There's one slight problem with that, is it's not shot like a comedy. I think he loves his set so much there.
What isn't shot like a comedy?
This film here. Oh, these guys are coming off and on stage. It feels quite long and quite empty.
Mm.
And I think it's because the set, if you look at it, he's framed it around the proscenium arch.
Uh-huh.
And it looks just, he obviously just loves that shot because he keeps going back to it time and time again.
Well, I wonder if that's, also might be because it's the only setup they were allowed.
The only angle they've got.
But the other thing is they've shot it low because they're doing it from a short person's perspective.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So Gilliam's career before this.
I love the baffled look as they look at the modern music.
Yeah.
And then the struggle they have to try and get the
looks
right.
Kenny Everett. Yeah.
So Gillian co-directed The Holy Grail, didn't he? And then did he co-direct Life of Brian as well, or was that all?
No, I think that was just Terry Jones.
That was just Terry Jones, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Terry Jones.
Terry Jones did Life of Brian.
Yeah. Okay.
What?
Go on. Terry Jones.
I can't do a Terry Jones impression. I can do Terry Gilliam.
Oh, because I've got
me.
Oh,
there you go.
I can do Terry Jones if you like. He just goes like this.
Yeah, he can't.
Oh, wonderful.
Yes, he
doesn't do it anymore, though.
No. This is this.
Poor Terry. Yeah. To be soul. Who's your favourite Python?
Palin.
Oh, Palin.
Yeah, number two. Jones.
Yeah, what are we rating them? What's the criteria, or do you not mind?
Just
whether you
favorite?
Like them or not.
Favourites. So for me, it's Palin, Jones, Chapman,
I'd probably go with Palin Chapman, actually.
Okay.
I think...
Well, it's Palin Chapman Jones are the best three, let's face it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's much easier to start at the bottom. Yeah. Because clearly you just start with Eric Idle.
Yeah. He's just horrible.
You're a unpleasant person.
And just but really, really unlikable.
Yeah,
he just always... He does write a good tune though, doesn't he?
No, I don't think that's true.
I think the Universe songs...
Yeah, that's true.
No, but I think what he does is write occasional good songs. But quite a lot of people can do that. I don't think there's anything particularly special about that.
I think some
of the theme tune for One Foot in the Grave's good.
Yeah, that is great, of course, yeah.
Did he write it, though?
I don't know,
did John Dupree write it?
Yeah, well...
Do you know what John Dupree... Because he wrote... co-wrote most of his stuff with him. Mm. Do you know who else... What else John Dupree's famous for? He was a guy that used to play the trumpet in Modern Romance.
Oh, right, really?
Yeah, that's John Dupree.
Wow.
That's a good
fact. What
was that hit? Yeah, whoa, makes me want to dance. Whoa, best years of our life.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Wow. So the guy that goes, bam, 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 that's John Dupree.
Wow, that's pretty
impressive. He wrote the Shite soundtrack for... Fish Called Wanda.
The Shite soundtrack. Yeah.
Just really 80s.
Fish Called Wanda has not aged well, has it?
No, it hasn't.
I loved it at the time.
I loved it. Saw the premiere of it at the Edinburgh Film Festival.
Did you?
But it's not aged well.
I was never really that struck with it. I don't dislike it. I think I've bored everybody with this before.
It's a masterpiece compared to Fierce Creatures.
Oh, fuck me, man.
Saw that cinema as well.
I did too.
So what's
there's another one, I think, in that sequence that's even worse. Ended which is Splitting Ears.
I think it's fucking
appalling.
I think you can say Clockwise because that's a good film.
But I think Clockwise stands on its own.
Yeah.
It does, yeah. Because it isn't written by any of them, is it?
No, it's written by Michael Green.
Please just happened to be in it. But A Fish Called Wanda.
I saw that in the pictures as well, Clockwise.
Yeah. Fish Called Wanda at the time, I thought it was such a funny film.
Really?
Yeah, we drove through to Glasgow to see it and my sister went to see The Mission. instead, as in the band, not the film.
Oh, that's okay then. I thought you meant the film. That'd be shit.
And then she got into trouble because when we came out...
I'll never get those ears
back. When we came out seeing A Fish Called Wanda, the gig had finished and she was nowhere to be found. And then eventually she turned up.
I know which is happening. She's been snogged by some wee gothy guy.
Probably. So there we go.
In a Dracula shop.
That was one of the first times I went with Clockwise, though.
You can guess what it is.
You like things going anti-clockwise?
No, it's just my anxiety about travel and things like that.
Oh yeah, about missing stuff
and not getting. To
oh no,
places.
No, but I can get that because it's clearly what it's meant to do though.
Yeah.
Because when you watch it and it's like, but I think there's something very. Michael Frayn, I think, probably did deliberately. There's something very Basil Fawlty about it because actually the initial problem is not that big a problem.
Yeah.
Because he leaves his speech on the train.
Right.
So he's going to open. He's going to be the first state school headmaster to give a speech to the annual convention of posh conference. Headmasters.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
They're all private schools and all that. Public schools, the fucking English call them. Right, so, and then he gets on the train and he leaves, or he gets on the train and it's the wrong train, so he goes to the other train and he's left his speech behind.
Right.
That's not that big a deal. The character makes it a big deal.
Yeah.
So most of what happens to Basil
Fawlty. So are you saying that's a good thing or a bad thing?
I'm just saying it's a thing.
Okay.
That it has in common with Basil Fawlty, because Basil Fawlty, most of the things that go wrong are not that big a deal.
Yes,
he makes them a big deal because he's worried about the ramifications of the fallout and all that sort of thing.
He's great, isn't he?
I think that's a whole genre that Time Bandits opened up. Tiny wee guys in military outfits.
Do you reckon Ridley Scott said that?
I genuinely think that's
why they
look
just like
it.
Yeah, no, I think you might be right there actually, because they're dressed in exactly the same sort of costume. Those hats that go.
Yeah, no, I genuinely think that nobody had ever thought to put tiny little guys in sort of Napoleonic outfits before Time Bandits.
So
you see it all the time, though. You don't see enough.
No.
How many of them were well known then before this? Then? Do we know this?
Tiny wee guys?
Yeah. Was David Rappaport?
Well, Kenny Baker is probably the most well known.
Yeah.
Yes, of course.
Because by this point, he'd been in both Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah. This was giving a wee break from the unspeakable Anthony Daniels.
Yeah. I think probably
David Rappaport. He'd have that song about him. So.
Yeah. Why don't you just sing it, Jack? You're desperate.
I didn't sing it.
He was in Time Bandits. David Rappaport.
But yeah.
They are fantastic, though, aren't they?
You can't help but what dwarfs
absolutely
they are.
Absolutely brilliant.
Is it wrong to say that?
I don't know whether... I don't really know. Dwarfs, midgets? There's a difference. I know
they are
a,
dwarfs. All of them are dwarfs.
There used to be a difference, though, between dwarfs and...
I think so.
There like, still is. Yeah, in term, they no, have dwarfism.
But in terms of characteristics, it was dwarves and midgets are different.
They have dwarfism, which
right,
is
whereas midgets are just tiny wee guys.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Dwarfism is a missing chromosome or something.
Right, okay.
It?
What happened to David Rappaport? Did he not have a...
He killed
himself. Device, didn't he?
Yeah.
Poor fellow.
He went to America. He appeared in an episode of L.A. Law.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was in Hooperman.
He was...
In fact, he was in the series, I think, of L.A. Law, in fact.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah. He was, yeah.
As opposed to the what? The painting?
No, I think he's in an episode.
A series of tapestries. I don't remember him being in any more than one episode.
I think he was in more than
was
one.
Was he? Yeah. But in any case, I think it was like, you know, the work just dried up and and there's only room for one R2-D2, so
yeah.
Away he went.
There was R5-D5, mind you, but they wouldn't let him be him.
No.
They would never give him a chance, would they?
It was Hilda Baker's job.
It was.
I think that whole concept of a portal there, that was just like...
It's nice.
So exciting.
Yeah, it was completely staggering
like
at the time.
Door that opens
yeah.
up.
And it's got a lovely early 80s blue sort of light at the top of it.
Oh, now, in Michael Palin's diaries, which are quite good fun.
They're quite great, I love them.
Well, I've only read Halfway to Hollywood.
Oh, I've read them all.
Yes. But there's a lot of discussion of this sequence, uh-huh. of the filming of this sequence with Shelley Duvall, and actually, I don't think it works.
Uh-huh.
The bit where they're tied up and where, you know, I must have fruit and all that. I just don't think it works.
It works in what respect?
Well, it doesn't... I don't find it particularly funny, and I don't think it adds anything to it. When I was watching it as a kid, it was like... You know, it happens, then you're like, yeah, what was the fucking point of that?
Well, interesting.
Or heavens, what was the point of that?
Penn, I think, wanted to play Robin Hood, and they wouldn't cast him. They put Cleese in, so I think this role was written quite late.
To get him in there. Yeah. Well, Cleese is magnificent as Robin Hood. The whole concept of the way they do the Merry Men and Marion and Robin Hood is exciting.
So I understand I know that we've done our rankings of the Pythons.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But do you think that Cleese... Except he's a comedy genius.
We went from 1, 2, 3 to 6. We didn't put Cleese and Gilliam in.
Well, we said that it was basically Idle and Cleese were at the bottom, weren't they? So let's.
I think it's interesting.
Do we even put Gilliam in there?
It's not somebody I would include.
No,
in.
No.
So let's go for the 5 then. So that puts Cleese at 4.
Well,
and
so
the
I
only
would do...
bone of contention between us is 2 or 3, Jones or Chapman.
Yeah,
I'm happy with that, guys.
Yeah, that
I'm
works,
happy
that
with
works.
That. Do you know what? Another reason I like Jones slightly more.
Matt.
It's quite a wanky one. When I was at university in second year, I read his book Chaucer's Knight, which is really, really good, because he said that they had everything wrong about Chaucer's Knight, and he did lots of nice research into medieval society, and it's a really brilliant book.
Okay.
And he made Labyrinth.
So why don't
that's a big plus.
Yeah.
That is a big, big plus.
So what's your issue with Cleese then?
He's just ghastly, isn't he?
Yeah, I think he... his later period is really, I think, is badly, badly tainted as his legacy.
Yeah.
And I don't think you can actually call it a legacy because it's just because he is still working.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's just a body of work.
Yeah.
I don't really like that whole thing of people where they have a legacy as if like they did a certain amount of work and now they're living off it.
Yes.
Is that really annoying shit that they used to talk about Peter Cook?
Uh-huh.
As if the stuff he did right at the beginning is what mattered.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then everything else was just a sort of sad decline.
One of the few
things, just isn't true.
One of the few things to still be said about Stephen Fry is that he was vehement against that. He said it's absolute nonsense. He was great until the end.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Whereas Cleese has insisted on, you know, producing and working all of the time.
Yeah.
Well, you actually then have to just accept that you stand or fall by the work that you produce.
Yeah. Yeah.
And okay...
what's the last good thing you did then?
Fawlty Towers.
No, I think Clockwise is pretty good.
Clockwise,
but it's
but the thing is...
At the time,
I liked A Fish Called Wanda. I don't think it's aged good brilliantly,
but
it was a good film in its day.
It was a good film. I think that's...
That's pretty much it.
And then it's quite a cliff edge, isn't it, then, to Fierce Creatures?
He was turning up in things like Cheers and turning up in American Telly a lot.
Yes, he would turn up in all these things
and
be that really annoying caricature of himself.
Yeah.
And he was always doing that thing of, you know, seeing he was doing the SDP stuff and then seeing that.
Oh, I remember.
I'm only that's really interested the last, in business people.
That's the last best thing. That's the last good thing that he did. Right, the, Planters peanuts adverts. Planters peanuts. But no, remember them?
No, I don't.
Where he did two sets of adverts that were funny in the '80s, very, very funny. Uh-huh. One was Planters peanuts, uh-huh, where he stood alone and yeah, said, "This is an advert for Planters peanuts," uh-huh, and it was only shown in America. Uh-huh. And they said, "You know, and there is nothing show busy, and they say that we can't do any of this." So here we go, and it was a white background, and he just held a bag and went, Planters peanuts," and a row of dancing girls appeared and went past them. Yeah, and said, "There you go." Uh-huh. And then there was another one, was basically the same idea, uh-huh, actually, which uh-huh was for Schweppes, where he'd said there was like, you know, I'm doing this advert, but I'm not allowed to appear with it, and he would like put his feet up, and it was written on the screen, and he would pull things down, and it was written everywhere. Yeah. I think they actually might have been his last good work.
Yeah,
he became very boring about people in business, about how interested, because he made all those videos for them.
What was that? Did he, was
Video
it?
Arts.
Video Arts.
Him and
was Palin not
Jonathan
in on that?
Lynn.
Just Jonathan Lynn.
Jonathan Lynn, that's right. Palin, I think, just did work
no,
for them.
There
didn't
is
he?
there's a clear line. He's too nice, really. But there is a clear line in the diaries of him kind of fed up with Cleese, because Cleese fucked up Monty Python.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Took off and a half because he was the big star and why not?
Yeah.
And he's trying his best never to fall out with him.
Mm.
Yeah.
But it's quite clear he's fucked off with him. And Eric.
So that falling out.
That's certainly our reading of it.
Yeah.
That falling out.
Made that clear to.
Took place during the film.
Aaron Klein or whoever is the lawyer.
So it was during the Holy Grail, wasn't it, that happened?
Yeah.
Because there was like press visits and the press got wind of the fact this was going on and it fucked everybody else off because they didn't ask any questions about the film.
Mm.
They were just asking questions about, are you going to do another series?
Yeah. Fawlty Towers is magnificent.
Yeah.
But he also, he bought into it as him as the great writer and how he and Polly used to write it on wallpaper so it would keep flowing.
Or Connie Booth.
And he would say things like, she was lovely.
Yeah,
and he would say things like, you know, I come up with a script these days and I'm asked to rewrite it. Am I not allowed to be trusted with this? Well, actually, no, because I've seen Fierce Creatures.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Derek Griffiths looks embarrassed to be in Fierce Creatures, mate.
And they made that, they did that extraordinary, I love this,
David Rappaport's got a great voice.
He does. He's so fucking funny.
Eat that more ice. Neil McCarthy.
There's a good old Neil McCarthy there. He was great.
Yeah. He even gets people to pull great faces.
Yeah, we talked about him. We talked about him in the Steptoe and Son.
Steptoe and Son, right again.
Mark Miller.
Yeah,
Hi, Mark.
He's also in Clash of the Titans.
He is.
We should do a
Harryhausen
one day.
Titans,
yeah,
well,
he plays Caliboss, doesn't he?
Yes.
Yeah.
For years, when I was a kid, I thought he was Gareth Hunt.
Who did he
looks like
that?
Gareth Hunt?
Yeah.
Caliboss.
Gareth Hunt's to watch us.
That's very Jabberwocky.
It is, yeah, very much so.
But yeah, there's a thing about Fawlty Towers.
Look at all the arms in the thing.
What I love is that posh thing that Robin Hood does, you know, when he does the thing where he batters like runs. It's absolutely necessary. Oh, I saw another one. Oh, right, okay. Well done.
Fawlty Towers is actually incredibly racist.
Right. Well, there's a thing I wanted to talk a wee bit about Fawlty Towers. It's not really relevant, but you know.
Well, it's relevant.
Because I just took a notion over.
I think our enormous listenership knows these films are a starting off pound. We take in all of culture.
Yeah, we do.
This over the course of like post Christmas.
There he is.
There he is.
He's great.
Good. I watched all of Fawlty Towers again.
Uh-huh. What was it? What was the best episode?
Oh, Basil the Rat. Mm.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, in fact, when you get to the end of Basil the Rat, uh-huh, it's really quite astonishing.
Mm.
You know, that sort of tableau
uh-huh
of the inspector, the health inspector, sitting baffled holding the biscuit, while Polly is holding the tin. Manuel is dragging Basil out by the legs because he's fainted.
Mm.
While Sybil is holding the coffee and saying, I think it's like it's going to rain again.
It's
while they're
like
looking as if they're looking out the window.
Yeah,
it's like a final curtain.
Yeah.
That's the last episode, isn't it?
It's it's to get to that. It's just astonishing. After that, my favourite is
Gourmet Night.
No, communication problems.
Which one's
because
that?
I love Joan Sanderson so much.
She's great.
Oh, yes.
She is so good in that.
Yeah.
So good.
She was a wonderful actor, wasn't she?
Anyway, the point is, there's a lot long forgotten thing, Fawlty Towers, which is the space between the first and second series.
Yeah.
Because there, there was four years
between the two series. But the strength, I think, of the strength of Fawlty Towers is it doesn't do what other shows. Because I drew back in the day, and might have been on off the telly, about The Office.
Uh-huh.
I think the problem with The Office, the home version of it, uh-huh. is that between the first and second series, there was so much noise about it after the first series.
Yeah.
Before they started making the second series, that it self-mythologizes.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. It does a bit, yeah.
Because the first, the second series of The Office is entirely about embarrassment.
Yeah.
It's about social embarrassment. Whereas the first series is not about that.
Yeah.
You know, there's the episode where they go to the disco and things like that, and they're great, and they're, I love the first series of it. Yeah. There's not very much time for the second series.
No, I like it.
Well, that's like
Fawlty Towers.
But it is a hard watch.
But Fawlty Towers doesn't do that.
Yeah,
it just completely picks up from where it was,
yeah, it does,
and is similarly just as racist and sexist.
Yeah.
I mean, you in the Germans, for example, people forget that the episode of the Germans. Is that the stuff with the Germans is literally only the last eight minutes or so.
Uh-huh.
And most of the rest of it is the fire drill.
Mm-hmm.
And putting up the moose and the picnic and all that sort of thing and visiting the hospital. But, of course, there's the discussion between... Yeah, it isn't the Germans. The discussion between the Major and Basil about women.
Yeah.
Where the Major is talking about... taking the woman to see the Oval, and she says these people are inwards.
Yeah, yeah.
And he says these aren't inwards; these are wogs. And no, all cricketers are inwards.
Yeah.
It's pretty shocking.
Yeah, it is. And Basil's just saying, "Oh, you can't, you know, keep it down."
No, he doesn't say anything.
Does he not?
All
right,
no,
okay.
He just says, "Oh, women, you know, they've got one brain between them and all that sort of thing."
Yeah.
He doesn't make any comment on the racism at all.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Polly calls Manuel at one point a Dago bird brain.
That's right, yeah.
You know, I mean, it's
had they got divorced in between? Had they got divorced in between the series?
Oh, I think they did. That's interesting. That would explain
a lot.
She
was great. Yeah.
She was great.
Now, what he has now become a massive fucking bore.
Please.
One of the reasons that I fell in love. No, please. One of the reasons that I fell in love with Taylor Swift was when she was on Graham Norton with him.
Yeah.
And he's there with his, you know, sitting there. He goes, "Oh, you know, it's not about cats. She's not about much. She loves cats." He goes, "I love cats. They're cussed creatures, like women." And she just turns to him and says, "Oh, let's not do that."
Yeah.
And it's a lovely moment where she just completely takes it away from him. Yeah.
Of course, we saw him. I spotted him in the hospital once.
Yeah.
Yeah, up near my desk. In the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was in
your bed.
He was going to one of the operating theatres. Let's keep this analogy going.
Yeah.
And he was wandering about, basically actually just wandering around looking quite old and pathetic, just trying to find a toilet. It was like, it's
had he shot
amazing.
Himself?
David, I didn't really want
to. Since we in the hospital, did you bring him a bedpan?
I didn't want to get close enough in case he clung to him.
Yeah. Nice. Hey.
I'm the great David Warner.
Yep.
Fantastic.
His helmet's terrifying.
Never talk to me like that again.
Look at the arm again.
Now, I was, because we haven't done one of these in a while.
And there's the other double D.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, because we haven't done one of these in a while. I was thinking that we should put out a trailer in advance. But what I wasn't sure what we would have in the trailer, like an audio trailer, saying, "Well, hey, woo, we're back. Green Guide Films back." So what would you put in a trailer for Green Guide Films?
The fuck are you talking about?
To put out a track on social media to herald the fact that we're back. So what would you put?
But we put the whole thing out on social media. What are you talking about?
To build the massive excitement that we're back for.
No, I won't take it easy.
I will not cheapen these by being trailers.
I won't cheapen the brand by advertising it.
No.
So that would
damn
be,
you.
That's what you do.
That would be counterproductive, getting more people to listen to it.
Okay. So you wouldn't do it.
Damn your bald eyes.
Have we done trailers before?
Yeah, a little bit. We've never done an audio.
Hang on, this is what would happen.
We've never done an audio.
Let's be perfectly honest. What will happen is you'll just fuck off and do something yourself and stick it out without telling us.
No, that's why I was trying to get your involvement, see?
Why?
What do you mean, why?
Because you don't need it. You'll just do whatever you want. Yeah, we are going to do a bunch
anime
more.
Jack.
As long as we can get Chris to sort of like stop fanning about and make sure that we can do these. We're going to get a bunch of them. There's going to be some. There's going to be some celebrity. Martin and the Lady Rose are going to make returns.
Yeah. Proper celebrities.
And they'll be back for. We're going to do Alien Covenant at some point, aren't we?
Yeah.
And there's a film that's coming up for its 25th anniversary that we think was made for Rose that we've been wanting to do since the start of these.
That must be quite soon.
It is. It's this month.
Is it?
That's why maybe next week we need to do another one for that one.
Depressing. Alien Covenant, I think, must be about the 6th or 7th best alien film, do you think?
It must be just about, yeah.
The idea of doing the other...
It depends whether you're counting alien films, not in the alien
series. As you point out, the other film I'm not saying is depressing, the idea of doing it.
No.
It's the fact that it was 25 years ago is quite depressing.
Yeah. But we're not going to tell you what the film is, but I'll give you a clue. You ready? I have crossed oceans of time to bring this film to you.
That's good.
Look what your commentary has done for me.
Is it Dark? Is that Bane from Dark Knight?
No, this is Bane from Dark Knight.
Charlie says, was a revolution in Gotham.
To throw you out over the Pissing Bridge.
Because your accent changes so much on Game of Thrones.
There you go.
Nice. How was your Christmas, by the way?
It was fine. What about it?
I don't know.
It was fine. It was fine.
It's never the same as you want in your head, is it? It's never the
same as you want. No, because you have to involve people.
Yeah.
Did you get any good presents that would be of relevance to our audience?
Yes.
What did you get?
Himself here.
Right.
Got me a Sapphire and Steel box set.
Yeah.
Boom.
That was very nice of him. Yeah.
He bought me a lovely set of...
spoons?
No. Spectacles.
Children.
Yes. Got me some portmanteau.
I did about you.
Well, look, a big bag.
I buy you?
I can't remember.
You fucking smart.
I'm going to watch them.
He doesn't even know the films that I bought. Do you watch? I'll tell you what I got him, Chris.
Help me out.
I got him Tales from the Crypt. Ooh. No, I didn't.
No, you didn't get me Tales.
No, I didn't. I got him Doctor Strange's House. Doctor Terror's House.
Doctor Strange's House of Terror.
Yeah. And I got him Vault of Horror.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
So I'm looking forward to watching those.
Yeah.
Vault of Horrors on YouTube.
Well, you got me a nice T-shirt saying the wrong kind of nostalgia.
I did.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. And oh, he got me a T-shirt that says Glenn Hutchison's Robertson.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And Chris got me a lovely T-shirt that is actually. Did you get the same T-shirt of him?
I think you should.
I don't know.
I think you should.
You did.
Are you being served one?
I think you should. I think you should tweet it.
Yeah, we need to take photographs of that.
Yeah.
Because they're. I mean, I love your shirt as well, but that one is a stroke of. Design genius.
Now,
took a long time.
Talking of which, have you got
presents for us now?
I've got some presents from TV Cream.
Oh, that was nicely done, wasn't it?
I love it.
Is this to make up for the not having an advent calendar?
Is this
so that we'll let you have an audio trailer?
Ooh!
This, hey! Craig, I think you'll find it's yours. Pass this over to you.
I'm going to have this in the hospital to annoy people.
I'm not taking it anywhere near the hospital.
Yeah, because I got you a nice mug once and you fucking just lost it.
So what have we got here?
Yay! We have...
We need to get a picture.
Cream Kite film commentary mugs.
I'm Chris.
I'm Craig.
And yours says, and I'm... Jack. No, you see, that should say, and I'm the one they call Jack.
I'm known as Jack.
I am known as Jack.
My catchphrase is actually, I'm known as Jack.
I'm going to give you a kiss on your big baldy head.
Go on then.
I'm not.
Oh, bless you.
We'll need to get a picture with us holding them in the right order.
Definitely.
Superb.
Like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll do that later.
So that's your trailer.
That's Blake's Christmas present.
That's your trailer.
Now, do you know about the script for Time Bandits at this
point? Oh, we're watching Time Bandits.
Do you know what the script said?
Enter Sean Connery if we can get him.
Yeah,
or someone cheaper.
Oh, did he? I just guessed that.
He said in brackets, or somebody cheaper.
That's right.
But actually...
I think there was... Was there not a lot of to-do about getting Connery on because he could only do certain days?
At the end of it...
I know there's the thing with the firemen, but was there not a limit to this as well?
I don't think so, because it would be... I just mean filming commitments. Well, probably. I don't know. He wasn't that busy at this theatre.
I've got a story about that.
Although, this would be the year that he made the fucking epic Outland, which is a great movie.
The other thing about Connery in this film is, you know, his camera at the end is the fireman?
Yeah.
That was his idea.
Ah, was it?
Oh, was it?
Yeah, because he said that he felt that they didn't have a satisfying enough ending.
Well, he was right.
You don't have a satisfying enough ending. So if you pay me another £4 billion, I'll turn up.
And he did, and he did happen to be in the country, and so and they did just get those couple of shots of him.
Yeah, the him getting in and out isn't him. Yeah. It's just the bit when he turns around and smiles. Yeah.
So the
he is actually great in this though. He's about 50.
Oh no, he's brilliant.
Pete Connery. Fucking awesome.
Yeah, it's the same year that he made Outland. He looks great.
It is Pete Connery. Actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's when he looked his best.
He's, yeah, but even in terms of his sort of manner, he's not as dreadful as he was in the.
Yeah.
Because I mean, he's great in the Bond films. I mean, he really is great. Yeah. But he's dreadful. Mm-hmm. You know, as a person, he's dreadful.
Right.
Bond, Connery's Bond.
Yes, you're right.
Is a dreadful person.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then when he makes things,
by this.
When he makes things like the Anderson tapes and all that, he's still a bit cuntish.
Oh, and then there's The Offence, which is a really, really upsetting film.
Yeah, but yeah, no,
it's a great movie.
But what I mean, there's nothing really endearing about him in any of them. But when he hits this kind of stuff, when he hits this period, and he does like this.
He's likable in Outland.
Yeah, and he's likable in Outland, and then there's things like the Russia House and all that. Mm. You think, oh, actually, he actually becomes a person.
He can act.
Oh, no, he's a good actor, Sean Connery.
What's his best acting performance?
I mean, this rates quite highly for me.
Yeah.
Or does that?
Well, he is very good. He is very good in The Offence. He's also very good in The Hill.
Is, but in The Hill, he's like, he could be walking about with a t-shirt that says, "I'm acting" on it. It's not very subtle.
I know what you mean, yeah. I mean, he is great in The Untouchables. He's terrific in The Name of the Rose.
I think actually...
Indiana Jones and his dad, he's great, isn't he?
Indiana Jones and his dad. I think possibly The Name of the Rose is his best performance. Not just as an actor, but also as a film star. There aren't very many film stars of his calibre at the time who would have made a film like that. Mm-hmm. Shaved his head... Appeared as an old man, nothing starry, he's in an ensemble.
Yeah.
He knows that people are going to be looking at Christian Slater more than they're going to be looking at him, unless he can act him off the screen, which he does.
Which he does, yeah.
And it's very difficult to steal a scene with,
William
is dead.
That's good.
William Hickey.
That's good, I like that.
Yeah, who is the scariest man on earth?
Who went from looking...
Reverse crash zoom, that's quite...
William Hickey, who went from looking like he was about 30 in The Producers to looking like he was about 80 2 years later.
Yeah, and stayed that way
stayed
for the,
that
rest,
way
of
for the rest of his career.
Yeah. He was quite a character, old William Hickey, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah.
What's the name of the wee boy?
Craig Warnock. The character's Elliot, isn't it? No,
Kevin.
That's DT.
Kevin.
He's such a likeable kid as well, isn't he? I think that's...
Yeah.
I hope he's not an obnoxious... He's not a wisecracker.
He likes nerdy things.
He's a nice
lad.
Yeah.
And actually, his parents are fucking unspeakable.
Yeah, they are awful.
So when he meets him, he reacts to him in a really... So both sides of this relationship are actually quite touching.
Yeah, you can see why he can see why he would be so pissed off.
When he goes...
It being taken away, although the scene where he is taken away as it's a is absolutely epic.
But you know that it's also going to leave Agamemnon's heart broken as well, because he's
totally
really taken to him.
Yeah. And so we think that little boy didn't really do anything else. Is
I don't think he did,
saying?
No.
Like, I don't ever recall him doing anything.
I love his wee jumper as well. Yeah. That is literally how I dressed
at
that
age. Yeah, everybody dressed like that.
I think
that,
I could totally relate to him.
People.
He's one of us.
His dad! You're fucking right, he has chopped his head off.
Look at his lovely thighs though as well.
He's our bag lad.
Good looking man, Sean Connery.
Oh, yeah. And that is when he was looking as
best. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And that picture that I tweeted once of you of him in Outland with him holding a shotgun, he looks great in that film. That was the film that made me want to have a black Casio watch. Because they all. And actually, in shops, they had Outland display things from the film with the black Casio. And Mark Singer in V, who had a very nice black Casio watch that I liked. You liked Mark Singer in V, didn't you?
Chris? Yeah, yeah. It's not so much for his watch.
No.
I like his,
something else you would strap around his wrist, though.
Yeah.
No question of that.
I think one of the things...
On a 24-hour basis.
One of the reasons why I love this film so much is it has lots of charm.
It's a very charming
tattoo, though.
But then Gilliam's very good at that. Gilliam's good at charm.
Yeah.
I wonder why.
I think it's just to do with... it's just to do with tone.
Uh-huh.
It's something that not every filmmaker can impart. In fact, it's not something that actually quite a lot of filmmakers, I'm convinced, want to impart.
Mm-hmm.
I think they see it as fucking weakness.
Does You know what I mean?
Gilliam?
Yeah.
I'm not sure,
he's
actually. That's true.
I think he's quite a likeable chap. I think I think the fact that he likes what he does comes across. And,
right.
And
Barry, he's an enthusiast,
it's,
isn't
it's
he?
Very difficult, I think. And I, as I have continuously said, know nothing about making films in any sense. Is how you can orchestrate a production like The Adventures of Barry Munchausen and still actually have charm come through on it.
Yeah.
Not for the want of fucking Eric Idle.
And they're also very
terrible in it.
And they're very characterful as well. So you know when you've got like little crowds of people, they're quite interesting faces.
Yeah, he's good at that.
You know one of the things.
You go ahead.
No, I was going to say just in Eric Idle bashing.
Uh-huh.
One of the things I do resent about The Adventures of Barry Munchausen is that. Jonathan Pryce pronounces it. Oh, the real Baron the Monk often is that they seem to insist on giving what they think are the funny lines to Eric Idle, and he fucks them up continuously.
Yeah.
And actually, it's a mistake to try and have funny
Eric
lines.
Eric Idle's
in
bad
it.
at sight lines. He always looks like he's looking off to the side when he's delivering a line.
Probably looking at a checkbook or something.
That looks beautiful, doesn't that place? Yeah. The two films of his that I love. Also, Brazil, which I mean, in terms of world building, that is astounding.
Can there be very many more influential films from the 80s?
Possibly
than Brazil.
Not.
I'm not sure.
Do you know, I don't know. I didn't follow anything about it when it came out. It was about 2 years later, in 1987. My parents were going out, and I got it out of the video shop. And over the course of the weekend, I watched it 4 times before handing it back because I actually couldn't believe this film.
Similarly. I saw, remember that advert for Honeywell Bull?
No.
Where it had all the paper, it was like the Honeywell Bull printer.
Oh, I stole from it, yeah.
Yeah, with its, well, you know, I'm sure they probably paid for it.
Yes.
Because they used the same music,
yes.
The Hall of the Mountain King and everything, when it came at them.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, that's amazing. Because I hadn't seen
it. Then you realised you'd stolen it from
And then it was on, I don't know, you know, Movie Drome or something. And that was, and it was something like Movie Drone because it was flagged up at the start. You might never have seen Brazil, but, and I was like, oh, well, I've never heard of it, but I'll watch that.
Yeah,
and then you sit through it.
Yeah, and it's full of lovely little sort of, it's full of, like, it's one of those films that I know so well that I know all the sort of audio cues in it.
Yeah.
Is anybody, like, the bit with the Mountain King music getting tuned onto
the
tellies.
Yep.
Oh. And anybody seen Sam Lowry? Here's McEwen going, a woman, eh? If there's a woman involved, it's no stopping me. And the great joke about the personal carrier, which by the end of it, with Ian Richardson,
oh, that's
God's
right.
sake, it's a fleet of personnel carriers, haven't you sorted this shit? It's great, you know?
But the
picture me in these.
I mean, when you think of the other things, like, have you fucked that up?
No, it's right.
He dropped one of the recorders there.
Ah, so
right.
But you know, like one of the. You know, so the bit with Ian Richardson, like walking, whatever.
Yeah.
He's, blah,
yeah.
blah, blah, and he's going, no, yes,
yeah.
no. I mean, that's been used
so
many
times. Aaron Sorkin's entire career
based
on that.
Absolutely. And almost every.
Miller and Thingy did it as well, didn't they?
And there's the. Zack Snyder, of course. Ripped off or homaged, ripped off the fucking giant samurai thing, which has been used a few times. You know, there's just almost nothing in it that hasn't been used
it's
at some point.
Did you
but you suggested another film might be as influential.
Blade Runner? I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm just checking that there.
Possibly.
I'd put them on a par with each other.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Do you know that Gilliam, mentioning, mentioning Zack Snyder, you can't.
I've not got the second film ahead yet that I want you to mention.
Okay. Do you know that Gilliam also pitched to make Watchmen?
He was, yeah. I remember him talking about it on the Jonathan Ross show, The Last Resort.
Oh, right.
Oh, there's this thing called Watchmen. And I've been asked to. Oh, have you?
And he had. So there's
coming up next, Bendy Finger, Mr. Captain of Lionel Fanthorpe. Father, what are you working on?
Possibly a Willy.
What are you working on, not Lionel?
Hello, Jonathan. I'm Father Lionel Fanthorpe, and I'm working on Fortune Time.
Have you met Terry Gilliam?
Lionel
Fanthorpe's got really gruff.
Anyway, Gilliam's version of Watchmen was going to end. He'd come up with a different ending for the film. So there's the throughout Watchmen.
Did it involve Patrick Wilson's Bobby?
No, throughout Watchmen, you have the little boy. Yeah, the little boy is reading the pirate comic.
Yes.
Right? So in Gilliam's version, at
the Jack Butler,
at the very end, you cut back to the boy who's reading the comic, but when the camera pans out, it's now a superhero comic. And the idea being is because superheroes have now been eliminated from that world,
right?
Then the therefore they have become a fictional construct in right. the post Ozymandias world. Right. So that's how Gilliam was going to end it.
Great.
All right.
Fun.
There you go.
The other film of his that I love is The Fisher King.
Oh, yeah,
wow, okay. I completely forgot about The Fisher King.
Yeah, great film.
Can we come back a wee bit later on and talk about Robin Williams' film here? Because I also want to point out of other Terry Gilliam projects that have not been made.
Uh-huh.
I have seen a script. I used to have it. I'm probably not supposed to say this. It's on an old computer in there if I could get it working. A film script that Terry Gilliam wrote with either Charles McKeown or Ray Cooper, I can't remember now, for a Sherlock Holmes film.
Oh, really?
Wow.
Which was put forward and whatever, but never developed,
yeah.
Which I've got in there somewhere.
Wow.
If I can get the machine working.
So that would have been presumably pre-Guy Ritchie.
This is
my...
This is about...
He'd have done a great Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
12 years ago?
How interesting.
But interestingly, before it came... Because Sherlock Holmes is now out of copyright.
Yeah. That's right.
And I expected when it came out of copyright about 5 years ago that there would be like masses of it.
Yeah.
But it's almost like now that anybody can make it, nobody wants to make it.
Well, I've got Sherlock, you've got the films.
No, but you know,
Elementary.
Like, but you know, I thought there would be loads of them. Where and I wonder if it's because if you have to pay for rights, you know nobody else is working on a Sherlock Holmes film.
Maybe everyone's.
Whereas if you're not,
and
you are, somebody else can start one as well.
Yeah.
I see, yeah.
But you know.
My dad thought that using the Titanic in this was distasteful.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Really? A scant 70 years later?
Yeah, I know, yeah. He was still touchy about it.
I think it's distasteful. Do you think that...
Although the Titanic wasn't
this?
The Titanic wasn't the thing that became...
No, it's true,
in 1981.
Hmm. Do you think Penguin's cameo works better here?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it matters.
The wig's funny, yeah. And they're sort of integrated into the action better. Mm-hmm. Shelley Duvall had actually escaped from the set of The Shining for 5 minutes during this.
I think actually the idea...
No, we're not being nice to Shelley. We're not talking to Shelley.
But I think the idea that somehow, you know, I think they're called the star-crossed lovers
right.
in the script.
Uh-huh.
That they were, you know, like somehow it matters that they're in the two linked. It doesn't work.
No, you're right. These are no consequence.
We care at all.
They are fantastic.
No more caviar. Makes me throw up, you know.
Yeah. They're fantastic.
Pooby Kevin's all upset.
Yeah.
But do you not want to hang out with them? Like, I think that's the other thing that's great about this film.
Yeah, be great.
Love.
Absolutely.
Well, they epitomise that thing like the Marx Brothers do or whatever. Which is that they're just the sheer chaos.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, they don't care. And not in a bad way. No,
they're
sort of.
They're just
chaotic.
They're
just chaotic.
They're their own little group.
They are very Marx Brothers.
But you know, it's great. They're really acting. They're all acting and reacting in the background. They're not just fucking sitting there watching the action.
Watch this. I've always wondered if that's meant or not. When he gets this, and he's giving it, I'm a sort of man.
Yeah,
there's a wee sort of homily, isn't he?
Yeah,
we are the same you and me.
Yeah,
he's a great guy, actually.
We both
call this wasting it.
Yeah,
I know. And that's what's great about him, because to him, he's not wasting it; they're getting away with it.
Yeah, that's
so. Why would you not be enjoying it? Yeah.
More champagne.
Wasn't there was sort of intermittent talk of a sequel, didn't there?
Yeah.
There were plans, which I'm glad to say never came to fruition. Yeah. I know this is going to sound dreadful, but...
And I would say beforehand that Chris is a fan of the new Ghostbusters.
Yes, oh yes.
So don't worry about this.
Okay.
There were going to be another film with Time Bandits. They're all going to be women.
Right.
Which I think is a dreadful idea. Because I think it's really tokenistic.
I mean, I'm a very liberal man, but I can have seven dwarf women in a film. You'd want to have...
You want them, because what I'd rather have is them mixed up. Right. I mean, what would be quite fun is if, like, some of them came back and they were married or...
You can see films like that on the internet. he gets that in his ear.
Trying to be sophisticated.
Wait, I bought ice.
And was Gilliam going to make that?
Oh yeah, there were plans for it for a long time.
We got another one with woman.
But it didn't come to anything.
I think, but also, I think the thing about this film, one of the things that I love about it is, it feels like they do everything that you can do with the idea.
I think so. Yeah, there's nowhere else to go with it, really.
Yeah. You don't think, well, why haven't they been to this period of history?
No, absolutely. And with them at the end, when they go off to do their thing, it's kind of like, okay, they're back in the fold now, really, aren't they?
Yeah.
Of course, the ending we'll come to at the ending. It has the most astounding ending.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, incredibly
that looks better than the one that...
I was going to say, there's already more emotionally involving than that piece of shit.
Do you know, I've never seen that film.
It's really
I've seen bits of it, but I've never seen the whole film. David Warner's in it.
He is. Well, as is Ewan Stewart, for some reason.
Aye. But Ewan Stewart.
Oh, he's...
No. Then they tried running that way.
Bloody hell, man.
That's Kenny Baker.
Yeah, he's not much of an actor, old Ewan, is he?
Blimey.
He's in Who Dares Wins, which we've always said we're going to do a commentary on at some point.
Oh, yeah, we should do that, yeah. Anyway. You used to be able to say that the second half, or the second act, of Titanic was worth watching because of the effects involved in the sinking. The problem is... Actually, there are a couple of shots that really.
Yeah, when you see it now,
there's one where she's running down a corridor and the water gushing behind merges into her face and things like that. Yeah. It's pretty grim.
Yeah.
I forgot that the other great double D's in this. We have both of them, don't
we? Wearing uniforms that are not unlike the ones in Brazil again.
Disney, the sort of polythene.
And the steampunky stuff.
And also,
going on the back
as
well.
12 Monkeys as well.
Yeah.
I mean, the only other director that's kind of like him in terms of that visual sort of look and world building is Tim Burton, really, isn't he?
Yes.
So,
this sequence is great as well, isn't it? I love his.
Greeny.
I like all the.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, it's kind of properly confusing, all this kind of stuff. Yeah.
And actually, that makes sense because they're now going into a.
Fantasy
a kind
world.
Of fantasy
sort of
world.
Because their outfits have all turned.
Has it ever explained what this world is that they're in?
The Time of Legends.
That's it.
Where all these mansions. Oh, that's right. Peter Vaughan.
And
a late victim of the Curse of Cremorne.
Oh, there was one of. Oh,
he's
yeah.
Great.
Around the time that we did Tales from the Crypt, what's his name? Fell off the perch. Betty's dad.
Oh, Roy Dotrice. Did we not catch that?
No, I don't think we did it on it.
Oh, right.
I think we actually make a joke about I'm probably about to die. Mm. And wee George stuck it in his reverse QA.
Oh, wow,
which doesn't actually work the way it's meant to. But
It's...
I didn't clock that was Peter Vaughan. How weird.
Dave, you never clocked that's Peter Vaughan?
No. Another man who was the same age for 40 years.
Yeah.
Now, he's Catherine Helmand, I was looking her up today. She's still alive.
Well, yes.
She's coming up for 90.
Yes.
she was. yeah, absolutely.
I think we've seen that.
First of all, very milfy. She's already in her mid-50s there, and she looks fantastic, as she did in Soap. Beautiful woman.
Do you think she's in this because of Soap?
I think she must have been, because that's my point was going to be.
Oh, sorry.
I cannot think of anything
any
that
other
she's
reason.
In.
Yeah.
In before Soap. Yeah. Although, I looked her up, and her acting career kind of in America was kicking from the 50s onwards.
Yeah.
But nothing in the wider world until Soap came along.
But is she not in Soap because... I had always worked on the under the belief that the reason she was in Soap, it's a bit like having Leslie Nielsen in Airplane. Like she's in Soap because she was the sort of...
I don't know, very possibly. But
yeah, because her career is very proper.
Yeah.
You know,
he loved her.
Yeah.
She's in Brazil as well.
Oh, I think she's great.
Yeah, she's terrific.
She's fantastic in this.
Yeah.
She's really creepy.
She's beautiful as well, though. Yeah, because he's the sort of dumbass.
Yeah.
She's really nasty. She's horrible.
Yeah,
she's the one to cook them in.
Yeah, and she's got the one with the arms and legs hanging up and all that sort of thing. At last, I can really cough.
I love their ship as well.
Where was this? Where did they shoot most of this? Do we know?
In the Time of Legends. It's very good for getting work done quickly because it exists out with space time.
Ordinary time, yeah. Okay.
Very good for union rules.
Look at the fingers and all that. Mm. We're putting a fair dunt in these Rochers, aren't we?
There's no Terry Jones in this film, is there? Alright.
No.
Alright.
I somehow had it in my head that he'd co-written it, but it's not. It's Gilliam and Palin.
What I find particularly interesting about Palin's diaries, I mean, apart from the fact of them, is that he has that attitude comes through as subtext that a lot of people, I think, like him have, where they look like they're, and on the face of it are, very easy, ozy,
yeah,
pleasant, all that.
Yes.
But what they are is really, really driven.
Yeah, he is.
They get
shit
done.
Yeah.
You know, they get things written, they go to the meetings, they travel a lot, they work hard. Yes.
No, he's very hard
to make it work.
Yeah.
Also, what has Palin been in that shit? Because I think it's quite hard to think of many things.
I think he has by far the best.
He's got the best hit rate.
Yeah.
And so obviously he's very picky about what he does as well, I think.
Yeah.
I think he's got to the stage, I don't know, but I can just guess from, I can only surmise from what he's been in, where he's kind of does things that mean something to him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he's, we'd be pre-in things like the Wipers Times, because it probably means something to him.
Yeah.
And probably, I imagine, must turn down a huge amount of work.
He did a straight acting role a couple of years ago in that ghost story.
He was
set
in
Russia.
Yeah,
I didn't really like the programme.
I liked him.
I thought the ghost story made no sense.
Okay.
But I loved him in it.
The
start
of it was good.
Yeah,
it was rubbish by the
end. I lost interest in it so quickly.
But he was great in it.
Because the stuff in the start on the beach and all that was like cracking.
And him playing a Yorkshireman was nice.
Yeah.
There was a press day before the day of filming, and they sent the press pack up to wherever they were filming in Yorkshire.
Oh yes, I remember.
And so he did all the so obviously Palin made himself available for the interviews, and then all of the press and the crew were staying in the same, I think, sort of in the same pub, and Palin came down and bought all the Jenners run of drinks, and they were saying, "Well, that's really nice." And he was like, "Yeah, but we're all just a team, aren't we?"
Nice man.
What a nice man.
I read a nice story about another day, which he references in his diaries. And it was about him in Belfast. Someone had written this up on Twitter, and a friend had put it on. My friend Daniel, actually, and Hamadri, good guys.
Not good guys. No.
And it was about him being in Belfast in the early 80s, and he was doing an evening with show.
Oh yeah.
And he came out and he did his show, but it was his first time he'd done it, so he hadn't paced it well. So he rattled through it all in about 30 minutes.
Oh right, okay.
So he came out and he was a bit embarrassed, and he said, "Well, why don't you all go for a drink, and then you come back, we'll do a Q&A. And apparently there was a 90-minute Q&A that was just fantastic.
Oh, wow.
And this is the bit that's referenced in the diary. They say to him, someone did it as a joke, said, you know that Groucho Marx has the record for running around the theatre. The art theatre, isn't it? It was in Belfast. So he did it in 1 minute 40.
Yeah, yeah.
And apparently every time he's gone there, he does it.
I think that's become a thing in that theatre.
It's a lovely idea.
I think it's a really nice thing.
Wow. It's a nice story as well.
You know the series Around the World in 80 Days?
Yeah.
Do you know who they asked for him?
Alan Wicker.
For him?
Hitler.
No.
No, hang on. I think I do know that.
He got quite...
Phileas Fogg.
He got quite far.
Was it Bobby Davro?
No.
Oh, was it Duncan Norvell? And was it called Chase Me in 80 Days?
Was it Dobby Bavro?
No, it wasn't Dobby Bavro.
Was it Michael Bates... while blacked up like he was in
with a
snake belt on
his tub.
No, it's Noel Edmonds.
No.
It's no!
And I think...
Well, that's right.
He said, "I can do it in 2 days with a helicopter."
Yeah.
Yeah,
was it Jonathan
Cord on
my
maybe
fatalities.
Da-da-dun, da-da-da-da-da-dun.
Which have nothing to do with him.
Ow!
And he wasn't even there.
Yeah. I'm not going on air. I'm not doing the programme this week.
I think the other week was something like the 20th anniversary of Noel. Refusing to go.
Yes, was it Steve?
Steve was
tweeting about it. It was quite interesting.
Fantastic.
Oh yes, that's right.
When House Party was the most important program on
and
the
he just
BBC,
decided not to go on.
To the end top. Yeah, he wasn't happy with budget cuts and things.
Good for him.
Was 87 not the incident?
No, the incident was 1984.
84?
Yeah.
Another thing about
Palin. So he just didn't turn up?
He said, "I'm not
going to
do the show." He wasn't happy with it.
You're not putting enough money into Mr.
They
Blobby.
They showed a repeat.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Why on earth did his career come to a shuddering halt?
I know, it's funny that,
when you won't go on in your own programme.
No. And then as soon as your ratings dip, and then the show gets cancelled, you don't get any other shows.
So that's what, 97?
Yes, that's right,
Well, that's quite far into House Party.
Yeah, it was quite near the end,
Yeah,
and then
it was fucking rubbish.
And then he got BBC to put some more money into it, and they redeveloped it.
No, I liked it.
I liked it at the outset. I liked because the segments of it, I think, really worked.
Yeah.
But where it started to go wrong, for me,
that's that guy Pogo used to work at the office.
Where it started to go wrong for me was that it's really alarming.
When they stand on them.
Yeah.
Sorry, we were talking about house party.
Yeah, it was when they start. First of all, they started getting really shit people for the Gotchers.
Yes.
But then it started to become self-referential.
Yes.
Where they started as pals, and then they would do it to each other.
Yeah.
Dave Lee Travis going, I got you, you bastard.
Yeah, all that shit.
Honk, honk.
Yeah, they played, absolutely.
And they played around with things like MTV and so on.
So there was all that shit. Yeah. But the thing that really started to annoy me, he would do that thing where he'd be in the audience talking, and he would sort of do a nervous laugh and look around.
Yes.
As if he didn't really know what was going on.
Yeah.
But all the time.
Yeah.
And it became really obvious and staged and immensely annoying. I just can't be bothered with this anymore.
Yeah.
And then eventually the only thing worth watching in it, and there was a long stretch when there wasn't, was the Gloria Hunniford Gotcha Oscar, which they did on Noel.
Oh,
yeah.
Where
he got the family with the Wait Till I Get You Home, where they started saying,
that's right.
The kids
yes.
were saying like immensely embarrassing things about the parents.
Yes.
And the parents started to object.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it got really uncomfortable and really nasty and whatever. And then, of course, Gloria Hunniford appeared and it was a setup.
Yeah.
And it was, and you know, he was doing that thing, was like, oh, and he was clearly furious.
He was not
raging high.
He does say in retrospect he should have stopped it after 5 years.
Yeah.
People's recollection of that show would be entirely different, wouldn't it?
He just kept it going for a couple of years because of the money.
Yes.
Could,
it makes it sound like they didn't pay him after 5 years.
Can I just bring us back to Michael Palin for a minute?
Of course you can.
One thing he has not done in a long time, but he had a great spell of writing single plays for the telly or single films, whatever. He did one called East of Ipswich, which is basically about how he met his wife.
Yeah.
And it was a lovely one. And there was one about
the Phyllis Logan, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And there was one about them trying to redevelop a house in an old street with an old woman that lived in it. That was a really good one as well. And of course, he wrote The Missionary, which was fabulous, a terrific film.
Uh-huh.
You know, he had a really good spell, and he's in A Private Function, which is a great movie.
I do struggle to think of something he's in that shit.
If we talk, well,
that's the worst thing he's ever been in.
A Private Function. Well, you think about that. Uh-huh. A Private Function brings us back to what I was going to talk about earlier, which is a little bit about handmade films.
Mm.
These handmade films, by that time, it was making Private Function, had got itself a bit in a bit of a mess. Because there were two productions running at the same time, and one of them was A Private Function, and one of them was Water.
Oh, God,
which is shit.
Terrible.
Quite a fun premise.
Mm-hmm.
Immense cast.
Mm.
Uh-huh.
Shit film.
Mm-hmm.
And
even at the end has fucking George Harrison on stage playing
with Ringo Starr, and it's like, who cares? Yeah.
We want our freedom.
Yeah, it's really bad. But actually, there's a few great things about it. Fulton McCrae is great.
Uh-huh.
Reggie Perrin. is great.
Connolly
is good in it because he hasn't tried to act yet.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So he's actually just really funny.
Mm-hmm.
You know, show me no mercy. Give me no bail. I'm ready and willing to go to jail. And the other guy goes right now.
See, my people come to me. All they want is liberty.
You know, it's all great, and the idea of this island where like everybody's kind of Scottish because the missionaries used to come and fuck everybody and all that. It's all really good, but it turns shit.
Yeah,
by the end of that, you end think it's actually embarrassing.
Yeah.
However, Dennis O'Brien was so convinced that it was going to be a massive hit, he was pouring all of the money into it. And at the same time, they were making A Private Function, which they had to beg every penny for.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was somebody once characterised it as they were spending more and more money for more and more ridiculous demands for Water. Meanwhile, Alan Bennett was queuing for a bacon sandwich by a van, you know, in the Yorkshire Moors. And, of course, the thing that Palin... I wouldn't like to put words into either his or his lawyer's mouths. But in the diaries, it's really pretty obvious that the absolute glee that Private Function was a massive success, especially in America.
Which was a huge hit,
And Water was a fucking disaster.
Why was it a success in America?
Well, because it's charming and, you know...
It's got Maggie Smith in it, actually is quite well-liked and well-known.
Yeah, but, I mean, it's everything... Because they always get it wrong when they try and do... Because people think that... Or producers, I think,
fit wrong. Producers think that what Americans want to see of Britain is Downton Abbey and royalty, you know, pomp and circumstance, as if people in America don't think there are ordinary people in Britain. Mm. And actually, whenever they've responded to anything in a big way, the perfect example is Upstairs Downstairs, which was a phenomenal hit in America. Yeah. But the stars were the downstairs people.
Yeah.
Because they're the people you identify with.
Although I suppose you could argue there is a sort of link with something like Downton, which is undeniably well made. And Americans have this reverence for sort of British acting as well. The sort of, what do you call it? Thingy theatre,
Masterpiece theatre with Alistair Cookie.
That's great. Yeah. And there's an element. That's a lovely shot when this smashes.
That whole sequence.
And this reverse section now, when they look through it.
Dun dun.
It's just amazing.
It's Kenny Baker's face.
Yeah, I know. That's beautiful, isn't it? It's but you're right. I think there is something really charming about seeing. And I think there's perhaps also a slight sort of race memory from the Americans about what happened during the war in Britain and whatnot, and that's actually quite that kind of tickles them.
But I think they just responded in things like Private Function to ordinary people and snobbery, because Private Function is about snobbery.
Yes, it is. Yeah,
but Downton Abbey is just a soap, and I think people respond to it a lot of ways in certainly America on that basis. Yeah, it's a soap.
Yeah, I've never seen Downton Abbey.
Yeah, Upstairs Downstairs is one of the great dramas, and Downton Abbey's a soap.
Yeah. It's like Ed Sheeran to me. It's like I'm neither one way nor the other.
Yeah.
Anyway, but yeah, I mean that two-track production sort of demonstrates where they started to go wrong.
Yeah.
Right.
Because O'Brien started to get obsessed with more and more big films, big American films. Let's crack the American market. They were cracking the American market.
Yeah.
What was the last
missionary
one,
made of? Oh, well,
the wee models going up.
That's right.
Yeah, it's fantastic, isn't it?
It gets very complicated because it's sort of dragged on. Their last big hit was Nuns on the Run.
Right.
Yeah.
Which I think might still have the record for the biggest ever audience in Channel 4.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I saw that.
It certainly did for a long time.
It's not good.
Wow. No, it's not good. I don't really get it.
But it's dying.
Train's quite funny,
isn't it? Was Splitting Ears a handmade film?
No, they were dead by that point, I think.
Because there was that also film that the late 80s was called Bellman and True that was a handmade as well.
Yeah, there were that sort of morphed from. That was a bit like.
That was a TV, like Quatermass, it was a TV programme.
Yeah,
here and a film
it's a bit like
America.
The Long Good Friday, where it sort of became. Yeah. It was telly, then it wasn't telly, it was backwards and forwards.
Because that's what it grew out of, wasn't it? Like O'Brien and the Long Good Friday.
All that kind of stuff. Yeah.
What was the working title of The Long Good Friday?
The Paddy Factor.
That's right. Well done.
Yeah, because people forget The Long Good Friday is about the IRA.
It's about the IRA. Yeah.
It's not about Cockney gangsters.
Yeah. And here's another thing that shows you that it's all in his head because his parents and Jim Broadbent are.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he rises.
But you see what you mean about the glitzy.
Yeah.
Game show thing.
Terry Gilliam's not one for digital effects. I mean, clearly this is quite early on anyway, but if I can't really think of them being used a lot in any of his films, I don't think.
No. Digital effects?
Yeah.
I think there's quite a lot of them.
No,
he keeps making
But even like 12 Monkeys would have been in the era where he could have had digital effects.
His last film was.
Well, his most recent film, I should say. That's about
was it not that one? He's made a bunch in a row. There's one called Tideland, is it, or something?
Right.
Which is about junkies.
Oh, wow. Right. Sounds great.
He made that, about 20 years ago now. He made the. Fear and Loathing film.
That's right.
Garbage.
Oh yeah, I couldn't care less.
But also, if you haven't got over,
I wouldn't get over
Hunter S. Thompson by the time you're 21.
There's one reason to read Hunter S. Thompson, which is
Fear and Loathing on the Camping Trail.
Yeah, and like the Great Shark Hunt and things like that. The actual reportage following Nixon is
great.
Phenomenal.
Yeah.
But see, all the rest of it is like some mad old bastard shooting up cars in the woods. Who gives a fuck? Like you say, it's kind of like. The sort of thing you should grow out of.
Yeah.
Like listening to Mahler.
It's what a certain type of man thinks being your own man is
all
about.
Absolutely.
And then he made that film that what's his name was in Heath Ledger and they had to recast it. The
Brothers Grimm thing.
There's one called The Something of Something Something.
Oh, the Pandorica opening of Megalium.
I mean, I've not seen any of his films.
That's
him.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
I've not seen any of his films for years.
But
The Brothers Grimm's quite good.
Is it?
Yeah.
But this
film called The Brothers Grimm.
Yes.
This film's aged really well, though, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. It looks great.
Yeah, in a way that actually things beautiful. Like The Brothers Grimm hasn't probably. Well, I mean, I'd say I liked it. I liked it the first time I saw it. And I watched it when it was on the telly not that long ago. And I
the Imaginarium of Dr.
Parsnium or something, isn't it?
Pangaphoria or some.
Fanthorpe? What's he got? An Imaginarium.
Imaginarium. Of Father Lionel Fanthorpe.
Of Dr. Father Lionel
Fanthorpe. And then. But there's Cosmo Dibbs!
It's good, isn't it?
Can I tell you. And well, just before you get to that one, I'll give you. This will cue this up better. I'll give you an unknown and unreleased story about a handmade production that never came to be.
Oh, yeah, okay. Is this an exclusive?
It is. This is exclusive. Wow. Well, I mean, it's in the book. But
it's in that book. Yeah.
It's in that book.
All right, okay.
So, the
Very Naughty Boys, that's what the book's called.
No.
They're not?
No, I'm talking about The Anatomy of Cinema. Okay, Michael Palin makes reference to Peter McDougall, the playwright.
Yeah.
And how he was always on the cusp of producing something but never quite did for Handmaid. Uh-huh. He did actually write a script for them.
Right.
It was called, I think it was called Travelling Men. It was meant to be about two travelling salesmen.
Uh-huh.
And it was to star Sean Connery.
Wow.
And
Ross Abbott.
I was all ready to make it, but it just didn't work out. And I said to Peter, it's no good, just write it. I'm getting bloody drunk all the time. You've got to have something to bloody do. But he wouldn't listen to me, so I went off and made water instead.
Yeah,
it was a nice film. I was in the Caribbean.
Wow.
As you can hear, it was an adenoidal Derek Deadman. So anyway, the
that was actually Prunella Scales. It was,
so apparently they had a smallish kind of window of opportunity to make it. Mm-hmm. And the both of them were committed to make it.
Uh-huh.
But there was one scene in it, I am reliably informed,
yep,
where they're on like a cross-channel ferry.
Uh-huh.
And I can't remember which one of them, probably adenoidal Timothy West.
What you said, what do you want to happen in this bloody scene?
He had to kick a dog off the side of the ferry.
Uh-huh.
Not a real one.
For whatever reason.
Tax reasons.
A Swiss dog.
You can't come in the country unless you kick a dog off.
I think every once a year on Swithin's Day. So anyway, to kick this dog off the thing, neither of the actors had a problem with this, but somebody did. I think it was Dennis O'Brien, did have a problem with it.
Right.
Like, don't quote me on that. Yeah. I've just said it. And there was a row about it, you know, we can't do that sort of thing, and blah, blah, and it went on and on and on, and eventually the window of opportunity closed. And then they never got to make it, and Peter McDougall poured a tin of Evo Stick over Dennis O'Brien's car.
Wow,
there we go.
Take that, you cunt.
They probably still get paid.
Now, this sequence here in the film, where they're in the cage.
That's an explosive!
Yeah, it's great. What I really like about this is that it's actually a proper plan that they come up with.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Rather than just someone comes up with a key, or it's like a bit of ingenuity.
But you know what's also really good is you can see the flaw in it.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
That's Strutter, isn't it? Is he Strutter?
Yeah, he's Strutter.
Strutter!
Yeah. No, that's Wally.
Oh, is it Wally? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. what you were saying earlier about them being analogous to the Pythons, I can't remember who it was, but somebody once on TV Cream made the point, quite a good point actually, quite surprising, must have been Phil Norman, that
what a handsome chap
is that it's interesting how the popularity of certain Pythons ebbs and flows, mm-hmm, and how for a long time young people would always have thought Graham Chapman was the cool one to think was the best one.
Yeah.
And then that kind of ebbed away, and then it became like Cleese, mm-hmm, and then that would change, and then it would become Palin.
Uh-huh.
It's quite interesting.
Hmm.
But
it's
never been there again.
No,
it's never been there again. But what I was going to say is what I think is interesting is that it's never Terry Jones.
No.
Which I think is a bit unfair.
Uh-huh.
And of course, it's never Eric Idle.
Yeah.
What's your problem with Eric Idle, Craig?
I just think...
Is it the same as my problem? That you just think he's a cunt?
Yeah, I just think that
he's not as funny as he thinks he is.
He's not as funny as he thinks he is. He always comes across all that sort of early tanned, I'm just going to pick up a guitar. And, you know, I remember him turning up on like The Last Resort all the time and whatnot, and not being funny and just not getting it with him. And it's that kind of strange thing that you think, you know, you can see that sort of paling. I mean, it's partly a slight snobbishness in my sense that I do like people who are sort of bookish and who like stuff. So like Palin and Jones are like that. You know what I mean? They're really into sort of history, or they're into travel and writing, and they've made good documentaries about that. And you just come across as people who are very British.
Yeah.
In a nice way. I don't mean it in a bad way.
Yeah. No,
who are really into that
way,
kind of history and whatnot. And you look at Idol, and he's had such privilege all these days. You know, he's well brought up, went to good schools, went to Cambridge and all that.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
And he's just kind of pissed it away by just being an annoying sort of early party sort of fly type. And I just, there's something about him just doesn't sit right.
Yeah, no, I agree with all of that.
And I don't even mind Spam a lot, which is great fun and all that, you know what I mean? And they all went along with it because it made them money. And I do think that the sort of the stage come get together, which I thought would have been appalling to see. I saw it on telly and I just got bored.
Oh, I didn't even bother.
That was reunion, purely the Python reunion. Yeah. Idol that wanted
I
to do that.
I quite enjoyed it, I have to say.
Yeah. I just, like a huge bar full of people.
That jack means absolutely nothing.
It's basically like a fucking sing-along at Glastonbury or something, you know what I mean? It's like stuck in an enormous fucking warehouse somewhere with the entire cast of unhygienic boars.
And there was a bit in there as
talking,
well.
When talking along to it, I don't fancy
wasn't
it
Sky Arts who carried it? And then there's a bit where they had to show a pre-record thing because of one of their sketches they couldn't clear for showing on TV.
Right. That's not great, is it?
No, I think it's all very unenervating. And as you say, I mean, it's clearly it was done for to pay for, you know, Cleese's latest divorce or something.
Yeah.
You know, in that way that, remember when they came out, what was it, the Beatles anthology? They came out because George Harrison had gone bust after handmade films.
Yeah.
Oh, and how the circle turns.
Yeah.
And because Ringo had no money, or because, you know, Thomas the Tank Engine had dried up or something.
Help us.
Oh, God, help us. But at least when that happened, it had never happened before. So they could at least keep for anybody who actually gave a shit about the, you know, every detail of their lives. You know, it was the first time it had happened. But that's not the first time.
It's
like, what's the point of this?
Yeah. I remember actually when
and they can produce good material. Because what annoys me is that they had come together once before.
89, just when the Chapman was dying.
I mean to produce new material for telling.
All right, okay.
Because there was a Monty Python night.
That's
on
right.
BBC2.
Yes, and they were in the cupboard, weren't they?
That was 1989.
No. That they didn't do anything in that. That was Parrot Sketch Not Included.
Right. Okay.
Where Steve Martin just opened a cupboard.
Yeah,
right. Okay.
And you can see that they were in a terrible state. Yeah.
No, they did the Monty Python night in the sort of early to mid 90s.
Right.
Where there were links between
the
programmes, and they were all dressed as gorillas in a zoo, and they all did like comedy schnick.
Oh, that rings a bell,
And it was, they were all there and they were all doing their stuff, and it was all really funny.
Yeah.
And of course, Palin was the funniest one,
being
the gorilla. Because I remember, the only thing I remember is him saying something, he was leaning through a tire, and then just going, ugh, which just made me laugh out loud.
Yeah.
So it's not actually that fucking new either.
Meaning of Life also has quite good sketches.
Yeah, there's a bit, but it's not okay.
Yeah, I really don't understand the downer that a lot of people have on the Meaning of Life.
Yeah. I think Every Sperm Is Sacred is incredible, but it's not even the best song in it. The best song in it is It's Christmas in
Heaven. Christmas
in
Heaven's an awesome song.
Because Graham Chapman's fantastic in it as well.
Isn't it also nice to have a penis?
For all
it's always nice to have a penis.
It's quite fun to have a cock. It's well to have a skivvy,
divine to have a dick.
From the world's biggest tadger to the tiniest little prick. So three cheers for our Willie or John Thomas. Hooray for your one-eyed trouser snake. Your piece of pork, your wife's best friend, your Willie or your cock. You can wrap it up in ribbons or you can stick it in your sock. But don't take it out in public or they will put you in the dock and you won't come back. Thank you very much.
That was frightfully witty.
These are terrifying.
Fantastic.
Yeah, they are. I've forgotten about them.
I've not talked about this film much.
I remember though, and the Beatles.
I think we should do these things twice.
The Beatles anthology stuff, and when they released "Free as a Bird," that was a big deal.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. But that at least was a big deal, and that at least hadn't happened before.
And they showed it on
"Free as a Bird"'s a bit dull.
Yeah, it is.
It's quite nice,
but the video was great.
Yeah,
I like the video because a blue mini pops out of a scene.
Yeah, the video was beautiful, and I think they there was like a little 5-minute broadcast. I think it was like for an episode of Cracker or something. It was on ITV.
Yeah, it got a big, but it was all tied into the anthology, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
It's made of Lego.
But I remember
seeing the Lego things. Yeah, it's clever, isn't it? Yeah.
But you can see the chessboard up the side when you go into the main hall.
I hadn't noticed that.
No, if you look at the bricks that are sticking halfway out, they're made of Lego.
No, I hadn't noticed that. But yeah, I remember where I was when first saw Freeza Bird, and I don't remember where I was when
1996.
Was it not sort of scheduled?
Freeza Bird? Mm-hmm. No, it was 1990. No, it was 1990. Oh, did you say 96? Sorry.
Yes.
Oh, I was bigger part.
Sorry, I thought you said 86.
I was absolutely cast iron right on this one, and I was ready, frankly, to kick off.
No, I remember because
I said 86.
No, I didn't say 96.
Because
I'd luckily it's been recorded, so it's going to be absolutely fine.
And then except that we can.
The Lego.
Recording.
Yeah. You control the vertical.
And then you'd be like.
So what didn't you say?
What year was that?
What year didn't you
say? It was 1996! Sorry, it was 1986.
Look, Lego.
I missed the Lego again. Oh, yeah, there it is.
Yeah,
see the wider shot.
Look, there's the chessboard on the side.
It's clever, that, isn't it?
And the little arches of the building blocks at the back.
Where it be?
See?
Pick it there. Lego.
Yeah, more Lego. So beautifully shot.
Oh, we've missed my favourite line from it.
What's your favourite line?
Where he turns Benson into a dog.
Uh-huh.
And he says, "Oh, Benson, you're so mercifully free of the ravages of intelligence."
He is.
Gosh, he's really blatant, the Lego.
Mm?
Yeah. I noticed it. Wow. He's fucking great, isn't he? When did Derek Devlin become a dead man?
About 2014, I looked him up earlier today.
Oh.
He was 74. He died of diabetes. He had retired from acting. I was living in France.
Right.
Oh wow. That's good to know.
It's like he'd
done his time. Done all the programs. Yeah. Chilled out in France.
He was in Never the Twain.
Ringo.
He probably had quite a lot of antiques in his house in France.
I'm not sure he did a whole lot after that, did he? I sort of always remember him as like. Finishing up mid to late 80s somehow.
I don't think of him
in the 90s at all.
No, I don't remember him aging in very much into the 90s. But I mean, he had done a lot.
Yeah.
Oh, blew the dog.
You're Benson. Benson, your time has come.
Who was halfway between.
I love that. I'm a reasonable man. Yeah.
David Warren is wonderful, isn't he?
He's fantastic in this film.
That great line when he was in History of Horror.
I don't think I want to be married to him.
Well, that's the great thing in History of Horror when they ask him what happened to the head from the Omen. He says, "I lost it in a divorce." It's the divorce that I really like.
The other thing that I think Gilliam does really well in this film is his actors all get it, don't they? They get exactly what he's trying to do. So he's obviously brilliant at communicating them.
Yeah, but I like to believe, and I have absolutely no basis for this other than I would like to believe. I think it must be true. But in the way Gilliam makes films, he most likely spends a lot of time with the people he wants to be in them.
Yeah.
Right. And probably like running through them all and getting excited about them and telling them all about it and then making them feel like, you know, I can really only do this if you're in it.
Yeah.
You know, and that sort of thing.
I hope so, yeah.
Yeah, I would like to believe that.
There's an enthusiasm there that's nice.
Probably in like restaurants like. That are probably quite stuffy, like Wheelers, what's that one in St. James's?
Wearing a cowboy hat and a sort of slightly too thick leather jacket.
But you know, like, what's that one?
Langham's Brasserie.
No.
You're not Wheelers by the dead, aren't you?
No, the one in St. James's that Alec Guinness was always having a Bloody Mary and gull's eggs in and things like that.
Yeah.
It's like a seafood restaurant or something.
Yeah, I know the one you mean.
He's always got his hair clipped in trumpers or something and fortified myself with a Bloody Mary and gull's eggs in whatever the fuck it's called. But you know, like, a restaurant that he would look... You know, like...
Simpsons in the Strand
sort of thing. Yeah, but you know, like, when Darius Jegbird
goes to the Tiberio restaurant in Curzon Street.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of thing, looked completely out of place with a giant white cowboy hat. Yes. I like to think it looks like that. And all the other diners are a bit miffed, but the staff love it because he's a big tipper.
This, of course, is totally nicked by Tim Burton in Beetlejuice.
It is indeed.
Yeah, I mean, like, the hat coming off, or the coming off, and it coming in and cutting it. It's absolutely.
It's blatant.
And who is the person that he does that to in it? Goulet.
Oh, that's right.
It's Robert Goulet.
It is Goulet. Yeah. That's actually, it's funny you should say that. The two people that are in that are really odd people to be in that.
Robert Goulet.
And Dick Cavett.
Yeah, yeah.
What's that all about?
Don't know.
Really,
I always a film that I felt was quite similar turning to this is Labyrinth.
Yeah,
trying about the same time.
Labyrinth
in terms of its take of fantasy.
No, 6 years later.
Was it?
Five. Later? I think Labyrinth's 86.
Okay. Yeah, Labyrinth. I think there's a big difference between 81 and 86. A much bigger difference than there is between 91 and 96. Yes. I would contend.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah.
I think there is.
I'd agree with him.
Yeah, but
well, it's just because the way things are, we've made a mention I can't remember in what context we talked about it before, but you know, like if you, well, it was in some conversation I had with some cunt, where like you know, the difference between like 71 and 79, is fractional in a lot of ways compared to the difference between 81 and 89, which time the country entirely changed.
Yeah, I think that's true.
But 91 to 99,
probably
interestingly,
not quite so
much. Jack,
yes,
you know what we're getting into here? We're getting very close into Mark Fisher's theory of the slow cancellation of the future. Because he contends that if you listen to sort of a lot of music now, it's basically built on sounding like stuff from the past.
Yeah.
Okay.
And if you play stuff like, and he talks about things like Mark Ronson's music and like the indie plodders, as he calls them, the, what were they called again, that band that did Valerie? The Zootons.
Oh, the Zootons.
Yeah. He says it's all deliberately sounding like stuff from 20 years ago.
Yeah. Oh, yeah,
in the mid-90s,
yeah.
If you played someone from the 70s, something from the 90s, it sounds like you know, to like garage or jungle or whatever, it sounds like entirely different. It sounds like from space.
Yeah.
And this is what he's talking about, the slow cancellation of the future. We are killing our future.
It's good to know he's put a name to something I'd be talking about
for quite some time.
No, because I can't remember what context it was.
Unfortunately, Puma Fisher's dead now, so maybe you could take over from him.
Yeah. I'm sure it was in a previous commentary where I'd made the point that, like, if you go from, in terms of popular culture, 1935, popular culture, mind.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
1935 to 1945 to 1955. Mm-hmm. It's not that major a difference.
Uh-huh.
Starts to move a bit in the early 50s.
55 to 75.
But 55 to 75 is extraordinarily different.
Yeah.
And 75 to 85
is
a light year of a difference.
This is the slow cancellation of the future.
But it starts to slow down again. Because
that's what he's saying. Yeah,
because 2005 to 2015,
you
could fall asleep, go backwards and forwards.
This is exactly his point.
You wouldn't fucking know the difference.
The difference between what we're talking about, particularly you having said the same thing with him, is that Mark Fisher understands what hauntology is, and Jack always gets it wrong.
I understand what the wider definition of hauntology is.
Yeah, okay, just not the one that you want to make up.
Anyway,
hauntology
wrong. Do you think that therefore that
Kenny Baker's about to
next generation, right? The teenagers or what? Well, like, teenagers now. Do you think therefore they won't have that same sense of nostalgia then that we have?
Yeah,
because essentially it's kind of much what it is now anyway.
But what they have,
and also there's abundance.
And what hauntology is defined as is a nostalgia for
the future
that never was.
Yeah,
there's also a strand to it. In my view,
it's not your definition, which is picture box.
There's also a strand to it, in my view, which is the cross generational break that has come through the collapse of films on television.
Yeah.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Because generations, and I mean across three generations, in the past, I think right up until the early 90s, probably the late 90s, actually. You could sort of cross-reference popular culture with three generations.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think you can do that now.
Yep. Yeah.
And the irony of it is that the material is much more available now than it ever was. But because it's much more available, there are not specific moments that you can cross-reference.
Yeah.
So three generations might have seen Tom Jones squatting on the front page of the TV Times.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Which is a toilet.
Which is one
South Wales for you.
Which is one of those things that lots of generations remember can actually erase having seen. By swimming pool in his.
That's right, yeah.
But because things were much more restricted, more people saw it.
Yeah.
That sort of opposite of the Thatcherite nonsense of choice means that everything is available, pretty much.
Yeah.
Which means nobody has anything in common.
Yeah.
Well, and nothing seen by a lot of people.
So Richard Alfredson.
Another part of that is that you and I talked about it. We talked about this in this very room one night. Hmm. In 1984, watching the Russ Abbott Christmas special, we understood what spivs were.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, it's also in the video for Come Dancing by the Kinks. You know what a spiv was.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Despite the fact that's harking back 40 years.
Yeah, not at all. Yeah.
You know? But we knew what it was.
Yes.
And in the early 80s, like, you know, I knew who Max Miller was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I knew who George Formby was.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know.
It's all gone.
All that's gone.
Yeah. Can I just tell a little note about Sir Richard Alfredson here?
Yeah.
Yes.
Is that he changed most of his lines.
Did he?
And on set, he said, that's not the sort of thing God would say.
Oh, nice, yeah.
Well, if anybody.
And I would know.
Yeah. I like the idea. I like the fact as well that God has a single breasted suit.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because I think the temptation would be to give him a double breasted suit.
Yeah, it's nice.
And
it's a
nice
three-piece suit as well.
Free will.
You know what he also has really nicely is that, see, when he takes out, I think a really nice move, he takes out that pad.
Mm-hmm.
And pen,
yeah,
and then gets him to sign it, but then folds it up, and it's the way he folds it up.
Yeah, he's not quite finished like doing it yet.
No, but it's just the way he folds it. I find it immensely elegant, impressive. Yeah.
You know, Kevin's little conversation with him about why do you let bad things happen? And he says, "Oh, I think it's had to do with free will."
Something to do with
now. That actually, for me, when I first watched that film, that was like genuinely a
revelatory.
Yeah.
It was like, yeah, okay, free will.
But it's the way he walks away. And then it seems to occur to him when he comes out, I think it's something to do with free will. But his best line is, well, I am the nice one after all.
Yes,
yeah.
That's right.
And the way he delivers it off camera,
yes,
as you'll see.
I like his nice substantial lower tum there as well.
Yeah.
Do you know what? Another thing about just sort of that thing about time and shared experience and something that struck me recently because someone told me it because I'll be 47 this year. So I was born in 1971.
What?
And I think back now to 20... 26 years from here was 1992, the year The Bodyguard came out and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
If I go back to that for my birthday, that was the end of the war.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That kind of freaks me out, you know?
I see, yeah.
It was not 26 years ago does not seem a long time to me now.
Well, it's like the summer of 69.
I was just about to say, tell us the summer of 69 one,
Jack.
Yeah,
that's the classic one, isn't it? So when did the summer of 69 come out? It was about 1986 or something, wasn't it?
So there are far more years have passed between the release of the Summer of 69 and the Summer of 69 and the song.
Brian Adams is 104 as well. Yeah.
But
he looks it.
But that
sort of thing occurs to me quite often. Whereas, like, if I think, but no, let's just, I hadn't thought of this before, but like, so I left school in 1992.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so if you count back from 1992 to now,
uh-huh,
which is what, 26 years.
Yeah,
so if you count 26 years back from 1992...
Mm-hmm. So that's 1966.
Something happened in 1966. I can't remember.
Yeah, I don't know what it was.
I don't know what it was.
Yeah, nobody ever mentions it.
Something to do about hockey.
Kinks really sunny up.
Something to do with free will.
There you go, that's what it was.
That was the same week.
That's Concentrated Evil.
Don't lose a single scrap of that.
But it is interesting.
Yeah, and I remember watching this at the time going, oh no, missed the bit.
That's bad, yeah.
Well, here's the bit that I love this where they did, you really have been the most appalling rock criminal. But it's. I wonder whose idea it was for him to deliver it off camera.
Mm.
I think, I like to think that was his.
Yeah, that's what I think. That's what I think.
Craig, have you checked your notes? Have we covered all of your key points?
Where have I got? Oh, I've ripped them off.
Oh, no.
Yeah, sorry, I've sort of.
Oh no, here we go. Right, this is the thing. Thank you very much. Yeah, we are. Yeah.
The only other thing that I've got.
This is the way he does this look. Yeah. Yes, well, I am the nice one after.
Yeah, it's nice, isn't it?
It's a really clever move. Although this is,
a year?
I think 3 years before he died.
One year before his best film, in my view, which is Dragon Slayer.
Okay. I thought you were going to say Kid Ulrich.
Before he died, which was just after making Greystoke.
Yes.
Which he goes down the stairs in the...
On the tea tree.
I've walked down that set of stairs. It's at Fleur's Castle. It's nice. Mm. The other thing about Down is that apparently Terry Gilliam regards this as the first of his Armageddon trilogy, which is this and Brazil and Baron Munchausen.
And what is... Why are they Armageddon?
Is it just because of the characters think Armageddon out of here?
I don't know what that was. But apparently, the Dream Trilogy or something, I can't remember. Dream Trilogy, say. But his point is...
That's a bit of a difference from Armageddon.
Yeah, okay, whatever. But his point is... The point being that there's three different points of view. A child's,
Then
a man in his 30s in Brazil, and then an old man in Munchausen. I think it's Dream Trilogy.
So they're all fictional constructs of the central character.
I think you'll find it's pronounced
Munchausen. Now we come to the astounding ending.
About a Munchausen.
So I think it was Connery basically said the ending is scripted, is too bleak and negative.
It's still pretty fucking bleak.
There's the thing.
Does he just get the fire engine?
He's just stepped
there's the theatre.
Because he just gets into the fire engine and drives off, does he not? Is my recollection.
He's just left there going, Dad, while the sort of and then you have smoke comes out.
The astounding pullback, which I love.
And then the immense.
I love the closing title. And I love a good title sequence, as you know. The end titles are wonderful. There is.
Yeah, he's great. Remember when firemen dressed like that?
But I like the fact that he, in that case,
that's not him,
had invested in it. I know, you can see it's not him.
Yeah, you can see it's not
nothing like his bulk. I like the fact that they've invested.
He was
Connery
so invested,
was invested
in
enough
it,
to say,
like,
you need to get this
ending
sorted.
But as you point out, though,
love is satchel.
He couldn't afford that many misses.
No, that's true. Yeah. It wasn't his purple period by any means.
Oh, he's got the photo still. Yeah, I've forgotten about that.
That's what makes it nice.
But that's what he has in common with McCarthy, is the ambiguous.
That's right.
But because I think what he does here,
don't
is
touch it. He it's gets, evil. Yeah, and you're like
he gets.
No!
Yeah, he gets the degree of ambiguity right, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Which is you kind of want to believe. Really, you want to believe it happened, don't you? That's what you want.
Dad, well, I'll come back to that.
It's like the Twilight Zone thing where the guy's supposed to be. Yeah.
It's brilliant. And I remember at the time watching this thinking, surely the fireman saw that.
Rod Serling said he missed a trick once.
Look at this, fantastic.
Yeah. That ambiguity. The one about the guy that's walking through I think it's the first episode, through the deserted town and whatnot, and not knowing what. And at the end, it turns out he's actually been in an isolation thing to train him as an astronaut. He said at the end, though, he should have had his hand in his pocket and pulled out the cinema ticket that he'd bought in it, but he didn't think about doing that at the time.
Yeah, and then it's like, Mum?
Dad?
His wee face.
No,
his wee British teeth.
Very British.
Now, here we go. Of course, it doesn't match the shots that have gone before, but watch this pull out. And I like the way that everything's running backwards there.
Because he must have had
to walk backwards.
Yeah, you're right.
Because it's all a bit weird.
Hadn't spotted that either.
Because you don't know what's going on.
Then the pull out. The music is beautifully peaking.
It's like Near and Far title sequence.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Yeah.
Here we go. And the mix into the music's lovely too.
That's all lovely. I wish you could get that.
Yeah, that'd be nice, wouldn't it?
It's lovely.
I like even the way they roll it up. And it looks like Richard Alfredson's
hand. It does, doesn't it?
And he does that.
Quite fussily done.
Yeah.
The logo is fantastic, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's that sort of...
beautiful.
Cosmic.
It's just a film that seems like it's had a lot of all these thoughts put into it.
And do you know what as well is that it's kind of nostalgic. The end is like nostalgia for the film, isn't it?
For the people in it.
Yeah. It's funny that, though, because there were a few films that did that at the time. Because the Porridge film does that as well, where it finishes with like scenes from the film, but they're like their little action and then stop.
Yeah,
but I quite like that.
Yeah,
I like also at the end that the first people it lists are the six time bandits and Craig Warnock, and then goes into the full cast afterwards.
Yeah, that's nice. Yeah,
Peter Bezu. I don't know what else he did.
What was I going to say? Oh yeah,
Jim Aitchison. He worked on Doctor Who.
Did he?
He did the costumes for the Deadly Assassin.
It's Mike Moran did the music.
Yeah. Really?
Mike Moran, wow. Costume Dead Assassin's good.
Music produced by Ray Cooper.
Gallifreyan costumes are brilliant.
Oh, they're good, yeah.
Yeah, but they're a bit too gold.
I think they're great. He won an Oscar adventure, I think, for costumes.
It's not the design that bothers me, it's the material that bothers me.
Okay.
It doesn't lend itself to studio tape, which is unfortunate. Also appearing in David Dicker.
George Harrison impressions.
Sounds like Bob Dylan, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Look at all those plumes. Oh, sorry.
Neil Gerald Martin, Wells.
Second Robert. Lovely Derek Deadman. I think that is a perfect film.
It is, yeah, it's a great movie.
Yeah, it's a great, I think you're right. I think it's perfect. I think it's edging towards a perfect.
There's not like
my category of
yeah, there's not
film.
Like a bit. It's like Flash Gordon in that respect, I think, isn't yeah. it? There's not a bit where you think, oh, this is a boring bit now. Or,
yeah. Yeah, no, that's the I hate to concede, Jack. Or, that's a really good measure.
Well,
because there are a lot of films that I really like, but you think.
Yeah, it's not quite perfect for what it's trying to do. That, and I think for what it's trying to do, it's perfect, isn't it? That doesn't necessarily mean it's the best film ever. Well, although I think it's one of the best films ever. I love Time Bandits.
I would refer you to the middle class Savile, John Peel, who said of when he defined Teenage Kicks, he said it's perfect and there's nothing you could add to it or take away from it that would make it any better. Yes. And I think that's quite a good description of something like this. Oh, Dave Everall was doing the rigging. Good man, Dave. So, Glenn Day, supervising carpenter, fag behind the ear. I don't know about you, Timmy. You can keep fucking giggling all you want, boys. It's not going to fucking happen.
Either today or yesterday was an anniversary of Flash Gordon, wasn't it? So what would that have been?
Sorry?
It was the anniversary of the release
Flash
of Flash Gordon.
Flash Gordon came out in 1980.
Yeah, it did, didn't it?
So what the fuck are you talking about?
Shit, are you talking about? Media feed. It's not
on
Facebook.
Fucking talking.
I'm telling you.
Some fucking idiots on
your social media. You know what the problem with that is? All these cunts in social media and the world who have suddenly discovered Flash Gordon
exactly.
and we were suddenly fucking like it.
We three guys, special thanks to Yvette Warnock. I bet that was his mum.
Yeah.
I bet she was there all the time. Lee Warnock. No, fucking Sean Connery's mum.
Yeah.
Aye.
Yeah, prick.
No, I know. Yeah, love this little bit at the end.
It's a great picture.
It's like nostalgia for a film you've just seen.
Yeah,
it's I'm saying that's what's
happening. Oh,
I've never actually hung on to watch this.
Yeah,
you're joking.
Look.
Yeah. There you go.
It's just like remember the good times.
No, I'm never usually one of these like I was there first, but I really fucking resent people claiming Flash Gordon now all of a sudden.
Aye, no, I do too.
Yeah, people claim
Flash I was there when it the fucking came out.
Absolutely. Yeah,
and no I was one taped it when it was on the fucking telly.
That Christmas of 84 or whatever it was.
I was there every year watching it on pirate tape at Andrew Calderwood's house. Every fucking year. And 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Well said. Right, that was good, wasn't it?
We did. And we'll do some more next week, so there'll be a bunch of them coming out.
Okay, all right, that's good. That's Chris committed.
And I'll have even more to say about the adventures of Baron Munchausen.
Okay. Well done.